Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 178, recorded the day after Christmas 2012, the best of 2012. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ford, featuring Bliss, the blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert and active park assist. Check out these available features on the 2013 Ford Fusion and 2013 Ford Taurus, and learn more at ford.com/technology. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of This Week in Google. You'll notice Jeff's not here. Gina's with her family. It is, after all, the Christmas week, so we thought it'd be fun to do with TWiG what we've done with other shows in the past and do a year-ender best of some of the best segments from this year's This Week in Google. We've got some good stuff for you coming up. Let's start with the fun that we all had thinking about all the things we didn't get, and some of us did get, at Google I.O. early in the year. I'll tell you what, I plus one'd. Wow. So Vic Gundotra is talking on, a little droning on about events. This is a new feature in Google Plus. And all of a sudden, Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, says, wait a minute. I'm going to let you talk in a minute, but first, Beyonce. No, it wasn't that. It was, but first, let's show, this is a time-critical demo.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, he ran on stage breathless, wearing the Google glasses, and just like, hey, you know, I hate to interrupt you, but just got something going on. It's a little time-sensitive, and up on the screen, you see kind of an air balloon or like a Zeppelin kind of hanging, and we're like, my first thought was, oh, it's a Google Maps flyover. They're doing something crazy.
It looks like that 3D thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it was actually
skydiving wearing Google Glass, Project Glass. It was amazing. Now some people are saying, well, that must have been scripted, right? I don't think so. I think that was time that the Hindenburg or whatever it was called, the Zeppelin. It's probably not the right name. The Zeppelin was right over the Moscone Center, and it had to be when it was there, right?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, yeah.
They can steer it a bit. They're not blown by the wind. It's not like a high air balloon. You know,
But why do you think it was so critical then that they do this at the exact time?
Oh, they do it at the exact time. I mean, maybe they had to have gotten some sort of airspace regulatory kind of permission, right, for these guys to drop onto the...
That's the other thing.
Did they
get permission to do this?
The four skydivers in a plane wearing Google glasses, jump out of the plane and land on the roof of Moscone.
Yes.
Which was...
doing a hangout, by the way. There's five divers.
Yeah, you can see
and they're in a hangout.
This was one of the most incredible live demos. Gutsiest. Ambitious.
Sergey said, here's the interrupt. Wait a minute. You can take it from my screen if you can see my screen. Can you see my screen? Wait a minute. Let me go back a little bit. Here we go. Sergey Brin wanders out in the middle of Vic's speech.
Guys,
we're gonna do something
pretty magical here, and we have a special surprise for you.
We've got something pretty special for you. It's a little bit time sensitive, so I apologize for interrupting.
The good news is that Vic is very poised, and he can handle this kind of thing. I don't know. There's a lot of presenters who would have been completely thrown by this.
It was actually really neat to see the difference between the two of them.
500 different ways.
Yeah.
Who wants to see a demo of Glass?
One of the reasons I like Google's keynotes, they're very real.
Yeah.
They know they're talking to developers. They're real. They're genuine.
Yeah.
And the developers, I think, appreciate that. They don't want to be marketed to.
Mm-hmm.
So much,
mm-hmm. Yep.
So they had these guys up in this Zeppelin. I'm told it's a Zeppelin because it's a rigid frame, not a blimp.
Well, okay. We can see that on screen, but they actually jumped out of a plane. I think the Zeppelin must have just been
No, it was a Zeppelin. It was the.
Oh, they. Because I thought you could see the wing when they were coming out.
No, I think they jumped out of the Zeppelin.
It's the gondola on the.
Because they were hovering.
Okay.
Right. See,
okay.
The wing is probably that little fin there. Mm-hmm. So they have a couple of guys.
Right. You're right. We just saw the shot up
in the Zeppelin, and they had a hangout, And they have squirrel suits. They have those flight suits.
I know, those flight suits are so cool. Yeah, those are so cool. They must have been able to steer that way a little bit.
He said that. We can steer a little bit. We've got to be over the top. They did a perfect landing on the roof.
Yeah.
And then they biked and rappelled and ran into...
Here, I've got it on my screen here if you want to chat.
Which is great for their landing. I lent you down here, and I thought maybe you guys could show us a fun time on the way down.
Let me skip forward a bit, because they took a while to actually jump.
Yeah.
Down. It looks like a long way
but
down.
Yes, so somebody in the chat room was saying the quality looked too good for it to be Google Glasses, but they had someone with a camera on as well. You could see that they were cutting back and
they
forth.
Do cut, when yeah. they cut, you cut, they cut to a much better quality picture. So, the glasses do not have 3G or they're Wi-Fi only right now. And so this is clearly not Wi-Fi. I would guess that the glasses were connected to a pack that had 3 or 4G built into it. Here he is.
They had
coming down. We speculated that it was maybe a live view, which we've used. They have a very small unit it could have been. There's other companies making something similar.
I thought I saw some wires kind of coming off the back of the ear that went down to a battery.
It's a very good image, though. I mean, this is from the glasses.
Yeah, and then when they go to the ground, they cut to...
Then they have, so you can see, that's camera. A camera guy. Yeah. And you can actually see the camera operators running around a little bit. Yeah. Here are the people landing.
At this point, at Moscone, the whole hall was just everyone was losing it. But it was this, tense silence. I mean, the energy was ramped up. Yeah, they didn't. Well, it was clear. Sergey, it was clear that he was not sure that this was going to work. And he was amped and kind of breathless and excited.
Which is why you should do stuff like this. Take some chances.
Absolutely.
Then they hand off the glasses to some acrobatic bicyclists on the roof who actually took my breath away because they ride to the edge of the roof to a ramp.
This was crazy,
too.
They jump to the next building. Wait a minute. No. And you could tell the audience is kind of going, whoa.
What? At this point, we were all just like, holy
This
cow.
Is the best there's never been. And now they're handing off the glasses. Now, it's funny because as it turned out, this was a non-working prototype. Sergey pulled it out of the pouch and nothing happened.
Like, this isn't.
But that's not the point. Nobody's paying any attention. So now this guy's going to rappel down the side of Moscone Center. How did they get permission to do this?
How did they rehearse this? I mean,
look at this.
I'm assuming they rehearsed it at Google.
No, I don't know. They might have rehearsed it.
They showed a video at the end of them doing it.
Yeah, doing
right.
Some
they couldn't
have
done it at Moscone because it would have stopped traffic.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, look at that angle. The guy running down the side of the...
He's telling the guy, oh, no, we're not on the first floor. He ran all the way to the bottom.
And then he gets on a bike on the balcony and rides in on a bike and he runs people over in the
They aren't going slowly into the hall either. It's pretty clear that... So this is not the glasses. That's the glasses.
This is another stunt bike rider.
Yeah.
He now goes through...
A lot of hands. Akin to the Olympic torch being handed.
I know.
Off.
Yeah. And they're riding through right outside.
I'm amazed nobody got clipped, to be honest.
Actually, this was kind of like me running up 4th Street on the way to the thing. So.
Yep. And into the hall where you guys are. That must have been very exciting.
It was exciting.
Silly.
That's showmanship.
Yeah. You know, I have a press pass. I'm sitting in the press section. I'm trying to kind of keep my applause. You know, I'm trying to be cool, right? It was difficult, though, not to applaud for these people.
Pro tip.
Or if not the corporate tactics, then the human effort.
It's okay to applaud this.
Yeah, you got to applaud these people.
This is not a product.
I mean, they just,
These are amazing.
It was an athletic feat.
Yeah.
And then this crowd of glass-wearing athletes kind of, strutted in all badass, and everyone's taking pictures, and there were lights. It was crazy.
Before they do the slow-motion walk video of this? Because watch as they come in the hall. They look very studly.
Very studly, wearing the glasses. Yeah.
So very right stuff.
Yeah, it's like, right, that's pointing to the...
Sergey handled this, I think, pretty well, too. It was he made it a little more exciting by being... Somewhat uncertain.
Yeah, he was uncertain. He was excited.
I don't believe this is going to work.
He's a pilot, right? He's really into flying. So, not that I've ever met a pilot that was ever in support of skydiving. Now, why would you ever jump out of a
purple plane? We need the slow motion.
Yeah, but check this out.
The right stuff, isn't it?
Ta 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 ta.
Yeah, people were going nuts. It was pretty jaw-dropping.
That's a good demo.
Yeah, it was a really good demo. It really was.
Oh, man. All right. Absent that, we actually learned nothing.
No, we learned that you can take pictures.
But we knew you could take pictures. We've been seeing pictures for months.
You can take pictures, like from your point of view.
From your point of view.
Did they mention that you can also take pictures? Because with the, you could just take pictures.
With your, from your look, your here's a baby. And that picture is being taken by the mother.
So, okay.
So the question is, how do you take pictures? What do you do? Do you just...
Well, right. I know. Do you press a button? Are you shrugging? Are you?
They said that it is gesture aware, so you can go like this. You could blink. I don't know. They said it's paying attention.
It's watching your gaze. It's
like, there was a picture of a runner's knees. See, a lot of the pictures from your point of view aren't actually that interesting.
But I have to say that the baby video, so the skydiving thing was great and exciting. But not all of us are going to be skydiving, rappelling, and jumping across buildings every day. But looking at your newborn. Who won't give a big bulky
priceless
camera a smile? Yeah, I mean that was pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's true. And the newborn looks back into your eyes.
Smiles because he sees mom. Yeah, that's pretty powerful stuff.
Now, I thought this might get the biggest roar from the crowd at the very end. We're jumping ahead a little bit. Vic comes back on stage and says, "Oh, and by the way, we're going to let those of you here buy these." Did you get excited?
I was pretty excited.
Yeah.
I want to put those glasses on.
Yeah.
I was less excited when I heard $1,500.
When you heard the price, I was like, we're buying it. Well, and then $1,500, it was like...
And he said,
it's not going to work very well.
Right, not going to work very well. We only want people who really care enough about this, or as you said in the car up here, or who are really rich to try them.
I don't even want to buy. And then it's...
I'm thinking, can I expense that?
And then it's next year.
Right, and then it ships next year. So you order today, you can only order at I.O., and then it ships early
next
year.
So I have a text from Jason Howell of All About Android and TNT. He's there right now. He says, should I get the glasses?
Should we take a vote?
I think that what he meant to ask was, can I use the credit card?
He says, exactly. He says, you want me to sign up for Project Glass? You could have mine if you want. Yeah, with my money. should I say yes? Everybody in the chat room says yes.
I think you could.
Yes. Yeah. Do they keep your money? Or no, they probably don't bill you till later.
But my favorite tweet of the entire morning was Tom.
Order one pair.
Tom tweeted Eileen in all caps, order the glasses! Exclamation point.
And then they told us the price. And as I remember, Tom said, stop it!
But, it's... What it reminds me of is way back when I used to do video game development, and they would bring out a new console, and you had to pay for the development machine.
Sure.
You know? Prototypes are expensive and one-off things.
Sure.
This is not an early manufacturing run. This is like, we got a bunch of these that, the ones they're wearing, they probably were handmade.
Right.
This batch will be an early manufacturing run, and it'll be flaky, and they want to make sure that... I think it's deliberately to deter. They probably set that price deliberately to deter people from going, oh, yeah, sure. And it's like, oh, well, that's like a whole new laptop.
Delta 9 is pointing out that I could probably sell it for $3,000.
Yeah, I mean, that was right.
I could make a little money on the side there.
I'm going to try to use that argument with my wife.
When we're done, we'll sell it on eBay.
Yeah, we'll make a profit, honey, really. It's cool.
I probably will, actually.
I look like a complete dork, but really, we'll make some money from it. I know
she's
they're not attractive at all. But...
Okay, but you cannot wear these outside.
Right, you can't
the house.
Wear these with anywhere where we're supposed to be look nice. Yeah. You're not right.
We're
not outside
the press conference. People trying on Sergey's glasses.
So this is the only thing. I mean, we still don't know. Even is it Android? Does it tie to a phone? Does it? How do you control it? We don't know anything about it.
Besides the fact that it takes pictures from your point of view
it
and
takes
video,
pictures and video.
That's all
and
we got,
and it's a decent camera, although.
Decent.
You take the sensor out of any Android phone, mm-hmm. and it's not that big. I mean, I could fit that sensor and all the supporting hardware and a small battery, I guess, into something that would fit over my ears, right? I believe there are things like this already. If all you're talking about is cameras, a chat room, isn't there a company that makes something that is basically glasses that you wear that take pictures? It doesn't do anything else.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't think that's particularly innovative. We'll have to wait and see. Yes,
well, I think the assumption is that it's talking to a phone in your pocket.
That's assumption, but right, I don't think they've even said that.
I think they've shown that, but yeah.
Is it Android in here? Or is it a peripheral for your phone?
Or is it an Android accessory?
The designer said they weigh less than sunglasses, so the battery isn't in them.
No, they said the battery's in them.
Huh.
They said it. I think I remember reading that the battery is in them. It's very confusing.
Yeah,
if the battery's not in it, then you're having a wire leading from your glasses to your pocket? Tell me that
they had wires on... Look. Okay. Hang on.
I don't know. I hope not.
This is Sergey with a thing plugged into a wire going to the glasses, and Liz Gans is wearing
this. That's the pickup so that you can see the output. You know what? Let's call Liz. Liz, what's going on with that? All right. There's more to talk about. There's lots more to talk about. This was a long keynote. We've now kind of shown you the really most exciting thing, right?
Yeah, well.
But that was fun.
Two other devices we haven't talked about yet.
I'm waiting, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. Also, Google Play has encryption now. Okay, developer, explain to me why the developers would. Does that mean, is that for security?
Yeah, I think so.
It's not any piracy.
They said it was signed for that one, so that basically you could only decrypt it on that device that bought it.
Right, the device ID
it's
is
DRM.
Actually,
yes. That was what they went over it quickly.
They did go over it quickly, right? But so it was a way to embed the device ID into the APK, which is the application package, to say you purchased this on this device. It's only going to be installed on this device. Personally, I don't care about this. I turned this off when I uploaded my app.
EA wants to know.
The incremental app updates I really like.
Huge.
That I was excited about. So
huge.
Only the parts of the APK which have changed get downloaded, which is great for everybody. Less bandwidth. Less installation time. It's just great for everybody.
And I'm assuming they're using that smart compressor they developed for Chrome that's really good at compressing code.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that makes sense.
Because there's a good tech talk about it, but basically they looked at code and said, oh, right, code is really compressible if you understand code.
Right.
And you can compress it by, if you understand what the address offsets are on all the pieces where the jumps are, you can actually compress it really easily because then you can move it about. If you don't understand that, all the address offsets don't work very well. So you have to turn the absolute jumps to relative jumps, stuff like that. So there's a bunch of clever stuff that they built for that, which is deployed in the Chrome update cycle, which is how they can do those updates so quickly. So I think they've moved that brains into this as well, which would be really good.
Yeah, it's really nice to see these things converge and to see different technologies kind of benefit one another.
So Darren Murph, writing for Engadget, says, here's what we know about Google Glass. They were able to talk to people at Google I.O. Engineers are experimenting with connectivity options. Existing prototypes, including those worn in the skydiving stunt, do not have 3G or 4G connectivity. Although it is possible such a module could end up in production devices. The general idea is latching onto nearby Wi-Fi hotspots or relying on a wireless tether with your smartphone. So there you go, with a smartphone.
That was the picture we saw.
Controlling Glass will rely on a mixture of inputs. It'll recognize voice commands while also taking cues from the right sidebar. We've seen Sergey do that swipe his temple.
Right. Right.
To do things. The touch-sensitive pad on there, they'll understand gestures. It's also probable Glass will be able to be controlled via one's smartphone, but physical inputs would be the preferred ones. There's an accelerometer and a gyroscope, so you could nod or shake your head. The internal battery sits just behind the ear on the right side. There's the battery.
Mm.
Nice. Nice. Good looking. Yep. Capacity and longevity not confirmed. Glass will be able to record locally, but the idea is to have most everything streamed live to the web. Great.
Of course, yes.
Take them off before you go to the bathroom. In an area where wireless data is not available, storing video locally would be possible for uploading later. So that's kind of inside stuff that they confirmed. They mentioned when they were talking about Play cloud messaging. Now, I was really interested in that. Is that sending intents through the cloud? Would that mean that I could control an app? They're close because Play will install. I can go on the web, say install it, and my phone starts installing.
It wasn't clear what they meant by that. They said go to the session, and they didn't explain it. I'm assuming it's an iMessage competitor. That was my take of it.
They did it really quickly. It was C2DM.
And it was like, what?
C2DM, so cloud messaging. They just said free for all developers, no quota limitations, but I still wasn't clear on what exactly
The existing thing that lets you send update notifications to the device, but I don't think they meant that.
Right.
I think they meant individual ones. That was
Android Cloud to Device Messaging Framework, C2DM.
Right, C2DM
is a service that helps developers send data from servers to their applications.
Push messages from the server.
It's a lightweight mechanism servers can use to tell mobile apps to contact the server directly to fetch updated application
data. Basically, it means your app doesn't have to wake up and poll, so it should be good for battery life.
Instead of polling.
Right, polling. Instead of polling push.
Yeah. You can your server-side app can say
C2DM has been officially deprecated as of June 26, 2012.
Ah. So I guess
it's now replaced by GCM.
Good.
Okay.
Google Cloud Messaging for
right.
Android.
So this supercedes that, right? Yeah. So it's deprecated.
This is the thing that they were talking about.
Does the same thing. This could be lightweight messaging telling the Android application there's new data to be fetched. So, hey, I got something for you. Or it could be a message containing up to 4 kilobytes of payload. So you could use it for instant messaging.
Yes. Or tweeting.
4K is quite a bit, actually.
Well, quite a bit of text.
Yeah, quite a bit of text, not so much for images. Yes. Yeah.
A very short piece of audio.
It handles all aspects of queuing of messages and delivery to the target Android app. That's cool. Yeah. I don't know if there's an analog in the Apple world, but I think there is. I think when they introduce notifications, they introduce some lightweight
push. Yeah.
Push.
Yeah. I mean, any app, right, that was going to update with new content that could benefit from that.
And then magazines.
that was the deadest audience response in the whole thing. And we've got magazines. And he paused. And everyone was like, okay.
Magazines.
Okay. I vaguely remember those. Yeah,
those. Magazines. What are those?
Yeah, they're the dentist. When
you
I go
print,
right.
There's something, yes. Magazines.
Movies for sale. Not just rental. TV as well on the Play Store. This was all sort of build up to
the Nexus 7.
So
you're both going to get one later today. I was hoping that you would push forward in the line and you would say, I want one. I'm going up to the brick house. I need to bring it for the... But you didn't.
It is a sea of very elbowy, backpack-laden nerds down there. And they said they were going to start at 4 p.m. Yeah. So that line at 4... In fact, I'm probably going to wait till tomorrow.
Right.
Well, I don't know if I'll be able to wait till tomorrow.
So
I'm going to wait.
Tegra 3, it's the first Tegra 3 device. That is a very, very fast system on a chip. They mentioned quad-core CPU and, what did they say, 16 GPU threads or something? Some huge.
The specs sounded very nice.
And when they demoed it, it looked fantastic.
The video games looked really good.
Really amazing. Real-time 3D stuff. 12-core GPU, gyroscope, accelerometer, 9 hours. Amended, by the way, later to 8 hours of video playback.
Was it amended?
Yeah.
And if you go to play.google.com right now, it's on the front page. It's for sale right now.
$199.
Oh, you pre-ordered.
You keep yours. You keep mine. That's yours.
Yes, sir.
And I ordered one.
So this is the Google's Kindle Fire for the Play Store. This is not an iPad competitor.
But more responsive, I think, than the Fire. Because I think
agreed.
I think Google looked at the Fire and said, "That's crap.
We can do better, and we want people buying stuff from our store."
Right.
So how often have you two rented movies from the Google Play Store?
I do it from Apple all the time. Every day, almost.
From Apple?
From the Apple Store.
Right, but how many times have you rented something from the Play Store?
Never. I've used the Amazon one.
I use Amazon quite a bit,
actually. I use the free ones on Amazon quite a lot because I've got Prime. Mm-hmm.
Why not use Play? Because you'd have to watch it on your phone. We're going to get to the solution to that in a second.
Yes.
$199, that is a shocking price. That's
great
aimed
price
right at Amazon, available next month.
Yep.
$250, $249 for 16 gigs. It's targeted straight at Fire. And obviously, unless you feel like the connection to Amazon is important for you, it's going to be a Fire killer, I would say.
I would agree. I mean, it has all the Google productivity apps built in as well, right? So the Fire is very much a media consumption device, an e-reader watching. But with this, you get Google Calendar, you get Gmail, you get all the Google goodness, Maps,
well,
you get all
that's
that.
The with
and,
Google Bar. Yeah, this is, you know, the Kindle Fire is not a with Google Android. It's an open source Android,
right?
Which means that they don't get all those pieces that you get by signing a deal with Google.
Right.
And so they were making a thing about that. You get the full set.
You get the
good.
Full set. Yep.
And it will be ice cream sandwich. Yes?
Yes.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, Jelly Bean. 4-1 Jelly Bean, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, presumably the Kindle app will still run on it. Has Amazon done a video playback app for Android? For Android, or only for Kindle Fire?
I think just the Kindle Fire.
I was wondering about that.
No. That's a very good point. I cannot watch Amazon movies on
here. Can I watch Amazon movies on this? I don't think you can.
That's a very good point. Anybody in the chat room, can you watch Amazon movies on your Android phone? I don't think so. Or on your iOS device either, no.
Right. No. The only reason why I use Amazon is I can download to my TiVo.
You can, but you've got to do it through the web and with Flash.
Right, you can do right. Certainly,
even
you can do it on the web.
You know, and
Flash.
You can do it on Google TV, and it's Flash, and it crashes a lot.
And you get
the aw
snap.
Yeah, a lot of aw snaps.
Yeah, a lot of aw snaps on that. I always download Amazon stuff to my TiVo.
Yeah,
you know, which is a pain because you have to say send to TiVo, and then you have to wait for it to download. So I'm willing to switch to the Google Play Store if I can get it on my TV.
Well, get ready because for a mere $300. I don't know why $199 seems like such a good deal for the Nexus 7, and $299 seems such a bad deal for this cube, but it does. They're the cue, I should say.
Cue.
It's anything but a cube.
Well, it seems like a bad deal because that's three Apple TVs, and the other yes! thing, and the other thing that's two-thirds the price has a screen.
Yeah.
So it's like, what did you put in there? And apparently the people saying the cost is they put a really good audio amplifier in there. It's like,
and now that's an interesting point. So there's a 25 watt one. Right. Even Sonos, which is probably the most direct competitor for this, sells a Kinect. It's $350. It's a little more expensive. That lets you connect to the internet. Sonos uses a proprietary network, not your Wi-Fi. It uses a mesh network, and it doesn't have an amplifier in the Sonos Kinect. But
you know, Apple.
And I have one of those, and I like it because I'm into the Sonos ecosystem.
But Apple sells two things here. Apple sells the Apple TV, which is $99. Right. Does this? Does the TV? You can't
hook it up to your own speakers.
You can, but HDMI. You have to use an HDMI cable and go into your TV speakers, which is all they said this did.
Which is how I do it.
But Apple also sells the little Wi-Fi extender thingy that has an audio socket on it that they've sold for years.
The Apple Airport Express.
That you can plug any headphone jack into and plug into speakers or anything
else. That's
analog out.
So that's
cheaper than, you know, that's still, now, that's $100 or something, right?
One of the reasons it's so expensive, it's made in America.
Yes, it is. Made in the USA. They made a point to kind of zoom in on that label kind of on the inside.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was great. That made me really happy. And, you know, they're pushing the social aspect of this.
That drove me nuts. You come over to my house, I'm playing some music, you take over my playlist? That sucks.
No, but I come over to your house and say, Leo, did you see this kitten video?
You can add to it.
You got to see this. You got to see this YouTube video.
That's exactly what I don't want you to do. Did you see this kitten video?
Come on. Oh, but you don't do that with your friends. You don't go like, oh, and pass around the little screen.
I do it with AirPlay, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, have you seen this thing? Okay,
Apple already has a solution.
But it's screen sharing. They're saying this is a playlist. You can see the playlist on the screen. You can manipulate it. So it's kind of a turntable.
Dave MacD in our chat room says, a great idea. I have music listening parties with my friends all the time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And also movies. Like, oh, hey, I was watching, you know, I bought this movie on the Google Play Store. It's awesome. Let's watch it.
Well,
and
now that's not going to. I would guess that's not going to work because I would guess, but I don't know, that the queue is logged into.
No, they said it does work.
Yeah, if you show up at your friend's house with your Android device and you say, hey, let's watch this movie, it pulls it from the cloud.
On my account.
Yeah, it pulls it from the cloud. It just says, yeah, it detects
the queue. So the queue's not registered to the home user's account.
No, the queue is registered to the home user's account, but. When you log into it on the Wi-Fi, it inherits the accounts of all the people who are there.
Yeah, like it recognizes the devices.
That's cool.
So that was the neat part. And that's the piece, you know. And
so I could bring a movie over, in effect.
Right.
I could pay for the movie.
It's doing, okay, I'm going to, back in my day. When we did.
Did you bring cassettes over? Here, I brought a VCR cassette.
No, the analogy for me is the thing we did with iTunes when I was at Apple, which was. You can see all the machines in the room and everyone's connection and play that.
Right.
Right? And that was very cool.
Right. Even if you weren't attached, you brought a laptop in.
And that actually did work over the net.
Right.
But Apple had to turn that off because the labels got grumpy. So I was somewhat involved with that. And the version we shipped would play anything over any URL, so you could actually subscribe to anyone's music anywhere, but it would find the local ones easily. And then that gradually got turned off as the labels go, you can play music in other people's houses? What the hell is that?
Not going to allow that. Now, you can buy multiple $300 cues and put them around the house and plug in your own speakers. So it could have a Sonos-like.
So if you...
it is
Sonos this is up against, clearly.
But it's dead on arrival.
It's just bizarre compared to the Apple TV. That's the piece that I don't get.
I don't understand.
Apple is selling something in every retail mall in America for a third the price.
Right.
It does the same thing.
If they made this $99, it might have a chance. At $300, I think it has zero chance. Am I off base on that?
Also,
I want to play with it a little bit.
It doesn't have the screen sharing AirPlay thing. Yeah, they explicitly said it doesn't do that. And that is the other, you know, Apple TV is worth buying just for that. Actually.
Right.
Wait, what's the screen sharing
so
AirPlay
Apple TV,
thing?
You can from your iPad or your iPod or your phone, you can go to the bottom and say share my screen to that, and it goes onto the TV.
Oh, and so then
whatever you're doing can be
yeah, that's nice. That's nice.
And that's become the way we do presentations at work. So everyone has an iPad, and we just have one of those, and you just pushed into that and stuff gets shared around like that.
Right.
And they just announced at the Apple thing last week, the week before, that the next version of macOS will be able to send to that as well.
Yeah, that's so nice. So it doesn't do the sharing.
It doesn't do the screen sharing. It does. The nice thing it does is it does. You're not having to push. The problem with the Apple AirPod Express one is that you have to have your Mac open and iTunes running to send sound to it. Whereas this one is, no, just queue them up and it'll pull them and play them. So that is actually a better decision, and that I can see that making more sense.
For $400, you could buy a pair of bookshelf speakers on the Google Play Store that will then turn your Google Queue into a stereo.
Right.
That's, to me, the differentiator is the amp, right? That's it.
But amps are not massive, magical
things.
They're
not expensive
either. And if I am the kind of person who cares about amps, I've already got a separate preamp and a separate power system and a whole bunch of, expensive hi-fi kit from the expensive hi-fi kit store.
I think Logitech is just saying, thank God we didn't license this. That's all I'm thinking when I see it.
Well, I'm assuming that at some point they'll go, okay, we'll license this, and you'll get third-party ones that don't have an amp in them. They just have an HDMI cable.
Well, is there technology in here that you could like? I mean, what is
It's Android. They said it was Android.
It's a little Android device.
They said it's running the same chip as the tablet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Also, it's micro HDMI. What kind of...
It's not a standard... In fact, the connectors in general are a little odd. You have to have banana plugs for your speaker wire.
Banana plugs. They're not.
They're banana jacks. No. So
now
there's going to be a sudden run on banana plugs. I happen to have banana plugs at home. If anybody wants to borrow them, micro HDMI, which is a Type D HDMI,
standard. There's space for a full size one.
There's plenty of space. It has Ethernet. I presume it has Wi-Fi, and then it has Toslink. It has optical out. I don't think this is particularly competitive. I think Sonos was here first. I think Apple TV, if you're price sensitive. I just don't see this.
I'm not quite sure where it fits,
Especially with Google TV.
Right? Which we'll see presumably tomorrow, right?
Yeah, presumably.
The other piece is kind of a bit weird, yeah.
But this is the first device they said that Google has designed completely from the ground up.
You know what? It is pretty.
It's pretty.
It's got 39 LEDs that you can program to do anything you want.
What do we say? It looks like the training device, the Jedi training device.
Yeah, who said that? That was a good line.
Yeah, that was a good line.
That looks like the ball that Luke Skywalker used.
Or the Death Star, depending on how you want to look at it.
Use your mind, Luke. There, it looks even better with the banana plugs in.
I don't have enough.
That looks like an oud.
That's a little scary looking. It looks like something's going to...
Do you remember the oud? Have you watched Doctor Who?
Yeah.
I don't watch Doctor Who.
They squid like things like this and they carry
glue. You ever watch Glee? Because that's a great show.
Why do you think you guys know Doctor Who?
I hope you're enjoying our Best of 2012 on This Week in Google. Our show today brought to you, as so many of our shows this year have been, by the Ford Motor Company. I'm a big Ford fan. I don't have to tell you that. You've seen me driving around. If you're in Petaluma, you know that Santa drives a red Ford Mustang with TWiT license plates. Let me tell you, I love my Mustang. And I'm going to be sad to see it go. But yes, I'm trading it in because, frankly, I want the 2013 Ford Fusion. I'm going to get the energy, the plug-in hybrid Fusion. But the other thing I want is some of the hot new technologies Ford's putting in its vehicles, like the Bliss blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert. It lets me know if there's people in the lanes in my blind spot so I don't pull into them with a little light, a little tone. It also lets me know as I'm backing out of a parking spot if there's car oncoming traffic. It's so cool. These are little sensors in the rear of the car, probably radar or something like it. There's active park assist, which uses cameras. That's amazing. You press the button on the dashboard, say, I'm on a park somewhere around here. Watch for a space. The cameras spot a space that fits your car. They'll notify you. And then you go, okay, and you lean back and you let the car park itself. In 24 seconds, perfect parallel parking every time. If you've never experienced it, it's truly amazing. And frankly, I think it gives me high hope for the future of autonomous vehicles. It just works perfectly. I want you to try it. Go to a Ford dealer near you. Say, I want to test drive the Bliss system or the Active Park Assist. And, of course, if you're in the market for a new vehicle, the 2013 Ford Fusion and the 2013 Ford Taurus both have available Bliss and Active Park Assist. You can also go to the website, ford.com/technology, to learn more. Thank you, Ford. We really appreciate your support on This Week in Google. Now, back we go to the best
of 2012. Fortunately, I think one of the benefits of This Week in Google is we've got such a smart team. We've got Jeff Jarvis, who's an expert in new media and journalism. And we've got Gina Trapani, who's a programmer and an Android developer and understands, things like APIs and SDKs. And certainly her program, ThinkUp, which is a program designed to analyze tweets, is very much impacted by the Twitter API. Gina was there to explain what the new Twitter API means to people like her. Watch. All right, let's talk. Let's talk Twitter. It feels like I've been talking about this API change for a long time.
It happened right after the last show when we had the discussion about app.net. Right after that is when all this stuff
Isn't that broke. Funny? Dalton's timing is pretty darn good with app.net.
Yeah. So, it was Thursday last week.
Yeah. Marco, I first became aware with Marco Arment's post. He's the creator of Instapaper, interpreting some of Twitter's API changes. And this, what I would say, is arguably the gloomiest interpretation.
Yes.
There are those, including the guy at Tapbots, which is one of the top iOS Twitter clients, who said, no, it's fine. Don't worry about it. But this all comes from a post on the Twitter blog by Michael Sippy, titled "Changes Are Coming in Version 1.1 of the Twitter API." It gets weird after that. For instance, you can't detach photos in a Twitter stream and put them on another window. No other third party or social actions could be attached to a tweet. In effect, tweets have to be published exactly as Twitter specifies, no matter where you're publishing them. Tweets that are grouped together into a timeline may not be rendered with non-Twitter content. Comments, updates from other networks, or presumably circles, arrows, or...
Whoa, but they said Spotify was fine. I mean, not Spotify, Storify was fine, but that's exactly what you can do in Storify is annotate.
Right.
How could they do... It's not your content, Twitter. It's ours.
Oh, that's really what the battle is, isn't it? Whose tweets are these anyway?
Yeah. Jeez.
Flipboard's Mike McHugh left Twitter's board apparently recently, and Marco assumes because of these APIs, because it would have, I imagine, it's going to affect Flipboard. This is quoting from the post. One of the key things we've learned over the past few years, this is from Twitter, Michael Sippy, is that when developers begin to demand an increasingly high volume of API calls, we can guide them towards area of value for users and their businesses. To that end, and similar to some other companies, we will require you to work with us directly if you believe your application will need more than 1 million individual user tokens. And if 1 million sounds like a small number, you'll need our permission if your application will require more than 100,000 individual user tokens if you're using our User Streams product. 100,000. However, you could be grandfathered in. That's why the Tapbots guy is not upset. He says, well, you get double what you've got now.
And this is specific to traditional Twitter clients, not other kinds of Twitter products.
Like Flipboard.
Oh, it's just clients?
Yeah, traditional Twitter clients. The 100,000 user token permission kind of ceiling applies to clients that make large amounts of calls to certain endpoints that map to traditional clients. Does that make sense? So only Twitter clients, like traditional Twitter clients, are going to get hit by this 100,000 user token
ceiling. Well, that's significant because that means you, without Twitter's permission, you can't have more than 100,000 users.
Right, if you make a traditional Twitter client. But so something like Storify isn't a traditional Twitter client, right? It's like a curation. It's a curation site. Okay. FaveStar, Clout. Go ahead.
Well, but let me understand, though. But the earlier things that Leo listed about how you can't intersperse other content, you must display the tweet, is the full tweet. You may not put any other social action upon it. Is that right? That's not just for Twitter clients. That's for any
that's for everyone.
Use
yeah,
of the API.
That's for the Huffington Post or Storify.
The display requirements do apply to all apps. But the user cap is targeted toward traditional Twitter clients. I mean, Twitter's been telling us for 18 months that they are discouraging developers from making new traditional clients. They're saying this area is saturated and we want you to build on Twitter, but we want you to make products that are not traditional Twitter clients because we've got those already. That's basically what they've been saying for the past 18 months. And these guideline changes are just, you know, kind of like, and this is how we're going to provide that guidance.
Paul Haddad of Tapbots responds, don't panic. There's been a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt generated by Twitter's latest announcement. I wanted everyone to know the world isn't ending. Tweetbot for the Mac is still coming out. They're in beta now. Tweetbot for iOS isn't going anywhere. He says the changes to the API won't affect Tweetbot. All current API calls are made using Authentica. That's the authentication requirement. That's appropriate, by the way, right?
Yeah. I mean, This is the thing. Like, as you know, I'm a developer. I build a Twitter product. I'm building, you know, it uses the Twitter API as one of its primary, you know, part of its primary function, along with lots of other APIs, Facebook and Bitly and Google Plus, et cetera. And I read these changes. There are about five major bullet points. Three of them are great. Awesome. Per endpoint rate limiting. Awesome. Verifying pre-installed clients. Awesome. OAuth across the board. Awesome. There's one that's like, meh, because it really depends on how they enforce it. That's the display requirements. And then there's one that's pretty yucky for traditional client developers, which is the user token ceiling. But I got to tell you, like, as a developer, like, I got really, I was really frustrated with what I thought was, like, wildly sensationalized and oversimplified headline, which is that Twitter hates developers. Twitter's turning its back on the people who made it what it is, and they've turned evil. Like, I thought that was a really, I just thought that was a mischaracterization of what's going on. I definitely think that there are troubling parts to this announcement, but the majority of it is actually really great for developers. And I felt like there was just a lot of misunderstanding there. And I thought, you know, Marco has a section in his post about how there's a lot of subjectivity and uncertainty here because Twitter very, you know, specifically kind of, you know, very purposefully made a lot of these guidelines broad and open to interpretation. So we really have to see how they're going to interpret it. Do we really think that Twitter is going to ban any app that has an email this tweet link on it, you know, like just through, say, Android share menu? I don't think they will. If they do, that's awful, and I think we have a right to go crazy. But I think for the most part, these aren't, I don't know, I read these and I thought, like, not that bad, you know? And I'm building a company on the Twitter API, so you could say that it's in my best interest to be on their good side, and I guess, but you would never do that.
If you were pissed off, you would say so.
I absolutely would. That's absolutely true. I absolutely would.
No, I don't. Gina is not mealy-mouthed. She's many things, but mealy mouth, no.
But I mean, you know, we've had this conversation before, and Jeff and I have disagreed. Like, I've been pretty, I haven't been outraged about anything that Twitter's done. I'm concerned, and there are bits of these guidelines that trouble me because they could be enforced in really bad and onerous ways. But Twitter hasn't done that yet.
You agree with your colleague who suggests that you should interpret these changes like you would, say, an app store. Apple's App Store. It's just
this was the irony of Marco's post. Like, Marco's a guy who has built an entire business on the iOS platform. Right. You know, he's subject to Apple's whims.
And how's this any different? Yeah.
How is this different? I mean, I think what's interesting about Twitter is that because they built such an incredibly easy API and developers took to it so well, and how they're so good to developers through Bootstrap and the patent agreement and the MySQL open source, that they were really good to developers and now they're turning bad. So I feel, you know, they're turning bad, quote unquote. So I think there's a sense of betrayal. You know, like, they used to be good to us and now they're not. You know, Apple was always sort of jerks, yeah. Right? So you don't get as outraged about them. Or, you know, Google Plus, which hasn't even provided an API yet, or Facebook, you know, some of their terms of use in their API are insane. So it's just, it was interesting to me to watch the reaction. And I think, you know, Twitter really has to prove, I mean, Twitter's communications about this were not needed to be
mentioned. That's the key. Yeah. I was going to ask you that, Gina. So would you agree that the communications just leave a lot to be desired?
Yeah, they really did. I mean, I know Sippy, and I he's a really good writer, and it surprised me that it came across so kind of the tone was slightly doomsday from their point of view. Like, oh, we're about to lower the hammer. You're not going to like this. I mean, it kind of came across that way. And so, yeah. You know, I love that Anil, you know, my co-founder rewrote the announcement and kind of with a positive spin. I was like, oh, we could rewrite this announcement this way. And I thought that was an interesting sort of intellectual exercise. But yeah, I agree that the communications could have been a lot better. And I think that there were just parts of that announcement that were very developer specific. I think there were a lot of people saying Twitter's turning their backs on developers who don't really understand what per endpoint rate limiting really is and why it really is superior to what they offer now. Yeah.
When they say per endpoint, they don't mean per app. They mean per user.
They mean per API endpoint. So the Twitter API provides a set of endpoints. So an endpoint would be like a kind of question you'd ask an API. So an endpoint might be the home timeline. Or the endpoint might be your direct messages or your profile. These are all different like questions that you can ask the API. So right now you get 350 calls per hour across all endpoints per user. This change, you get 60 calls per endpoint per hour. So if you use more than six endpoints, right, because 6 times 60 is 360, and 360 is greater than 350. I know I'm doing this quickly. You're basically what Twitter's doing is they're saying you get more API calls per hour across a lot of endpoints with this change, which puts the squeeze on traditional client apps, traditional Twitter clients, which are constantly querying the home timeline endpoint, right? Primarily.
They're using one endpoint over and over.
They're using one endpoint a lot over and over, exactly. Versus products that use lots of different endpoints that do something interesting with favorites or do something interesting with pictures.
ThinkUp does.
ThinkUp does do that, yeah. So I mean,
It's good for you, bad for Tweetbot.
Well, right. I mean, just off the top of my head, ThinkUp uses over 9 endpoints, right? So that ups our API call allocation from 350 an hour to 540 an hour. So that's great news. That's great news for us. And Tweetbot doesn't seem too concerned about it. Honestly, even if you're a traditional Twitter client and you're being conservative, you're being smart and conservative about your API calls, 60 per hour per endpoint is totally reasonable.
So Tweetbot could make one call and then feed all of its clients with that one call. So they're saying every second or every minute you make...
It's per user per endpoint, right? So
per
like
user
Leo,
per endpoint.
Oh, yeah, it's per user per endpoint. So you authenticated, you have tokens, and your timeline is different than... If you hit the timeline endpoint, that the response is going to be... The payload's going to be different than if I hit it, right? Because my timeline looks different than yours. So it's per user per endpoint.
Right.
60 per hour.
So in Neil's blog, he said, our biggest Twitter API upgrade ever... More API calls for almost every kind of app. Better security by extending OAuth to all APIs. A clear roadmap for Twitter app developers to know what's encouraged. A few new restrictions for people making traditional Twitter clients. And when official 1.1 is released, you'll have 6 months to migrate. Some have posited, as like Dan Frommer in Read Write Web, this is Twitter saying we want to survive. They have to do this. Does that seem reasonable, Gina? It's not a money grab. They need to monetize.
I don't know, but that seems to be right. I mean, it seems to be why they're doing this. This is one area where I think their communications could have been different. I mean, you want to assume that they want to restrict the display of tweets because they want to be able to insert advertising or insert links back to Twitter wherever they can, right? Because they need the eyeballs and they want to keep Twitter users using their tools for the primary use of Twitter, which is your timeline, your replies, direct messages. This seems like this is about their business model. I don't think that I agree that this isn't a money grab. I think this is Twitter figuring out that it needs a business model and figuring out how it's going to do that. And they're taking the long view and saying we're going to start this now.
If they did anything wrong, it's that they didn't think of this ahead of time.
Right. Well, look, they've been giving us this guy. For 18 months, they've been saying, hey, like we got the client area covered, make other things.
Stop doing that.
Right.
In fairness, the founders of Google said, we don't like advertising. We don't want advertising.
Right.
I said that when
I started this network. Boy, that was a mistake.
Right. Yeah. So I'll give them all that. I think what probably disturbs people is two things. One is, the cultural attitude of it. People do feel as if they really contributed to Twitter's success by creating conventions, by distributing Twitter, by helping make it popular. And so the attitude was not, let me be fully open here and explain what we need to do and why we need to do it. And yes, we're grateful for what you did, but this is the reality of what we have to deal with. And people would deal with that, I think.
They should probably have
said
it that
way. A little bit dictatorial. Yeah. The second part of this, I think, and this is from my ignorant, non-developing view, I'm grappling with this in a lot of contexts, is what's the responsibility of a platform and what's the thus the reliability and trust you can have in a platform to build your future on it. I'm reminded of, and I think I've told this story before, when I took Daylife originally to Fred Wilson, he said to the founder, Upendra Chardonnay, can I build a profitable company on your platform? And let me tell you before you answer that the right answer is yes.
Really?
And when I complained about some features that were not existent in Twitter, Fred responded publicly, well, that's what the clients are supposed to make, the outside developers are supposed to make. So there's a compact there. There's a relationship there, a covenant that can change and perhaps has to change. I'm not denying that at all. But I just think it does come down to communication to say, okay, folks, we've tried a lot of things. Here's where we are, and here's the reality of that. And we want to bring you along, but you got to play by these rules to come along. And then I think it'd be a little bit different. And Neil has a real good point then, but it's not just about gloss over what exists. It's also about being transparent about the rationale, what's going on, A, and B, about trying to maintain ongoing trust. Because what Marco's post says at the end, I believe it was his post, said, I ain't building on Twitter.
Yeah. Well,
right.
That's the issue at the end.
Yeah.
Is if there's no trust there, then are they really willing to go alone? And the irony of this is, then Twitter does become a media company. It becomes a very old-fashioned media company. Well, just as I'm telling media companies to make themselves embeddable and spread their stuff out on the web, Twitter's saying, no, you all have to come to our website and we want our page views. That's so 2005.
Right. I mean, if developers interpret this announcement as a giant FU, which many have, obviously Marco did and said that he might not, he might just rip all the Twitter related features out of Instapaper because he can't bear to develop against Twitter's ever-changing rules anymore, which, again, I thought his reaction was extreme. If he interpreted it that way, the risk is that you're not going to have a Twitter developer come along and say, you know what I want to do? I want to build a business making a really awesome Twitter client that does all the things that none of the official clients do, right? I mean, that's how Tweety happened. That's how TweetDeck happened, all of which got acquired by Twitter, right? So that's how that innovation happened in the beginning. That innovation is not going to happen now because no developer in a right mind is going to try to build a company and a product with a cap of 100,000 user tokens, at which point you have to kind of apply for permission from Twitter to continue.
Exactly. Howard Lindzen and StockTwits and Twitter took over the convention. I would include Bitly on this. The funny thing is, various of these people who still work with Twitter in some way or another, I sense are being so cautious. But I'm cautious in becoming hypercritical of Twitter here because I've made mistakes before when it comes to Twitter. I didn't understand some of the good work they were doing internationally when they came up with rules, and I thought, well, that's a bad rule. But in fact, the idea that they would censor something in one country but leave it in other countries and make it transparent. I didn't get by that what they were doing was exposing censorship. It was a good thing. But I'm also a little gun shy with Twitter now after the Olympics and what they did with Guy Adams' account. That was a cultural problem of not understanding their responsibility as a platform. And when I argue that media companies now to become platforms, that's why I'm grappling with this. What does it mean to be a platform? Son Jake says, you build your business on somebody else's platform. You get what you deserve when they pull out the rug.
Right.
I kind of agree. It's funny. I was saying on Twitter that we have to wait to see how Twitter actually enforces a lot of this stuff before we can truly criticize. And Maciej from Pinboard and Jason Kotke, who does Stellar, they both said to me like, well, what do you mean? You're not supposed to protest a law until someone gets, arrested for it. And I was like, but Twitter isn't a democracy. We're not voting about whether or not this is okay. I mean,
well, but with us, Twitter is nothing. The first rule.
Agreed.
I wrote a post about kind of trying to explore these notions of a platform. And simply put, without users, a platform is nothing.
Period. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So it may not be a democracy, but it is a collaboration. And if it's not collaborative two ways, then it doesn't work as a platform because there's not two-way trust.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's true. My point was like, I'm going to be outraged if Twitter indeed bans an app for having an email, this tweet link in it. That no social actions bit, which could be interpreted very broadly. Like, I'll feel more outraged and I'll feel like they're truly evil if they, really don't want us to email tweets, for example, or share a link to Instapaper from a tweet, which is what Marco brought up in his post. And so, people were saying that that we should protest, you know, these changes now before we actually start to see enforcement. I mean, I'm going to learn a lot about enforcement because I'm building a Twitter product. So I'll let you know, if we get pulled over for something. But I think your larger question.
But Gina, isn't it a weird thing you're saying? You're saying that you are not going to build it to the letter of the law because you're assuming they don't mean the law.
No. I mean, I'm going to comply. I'm going to comply with the display requirements. I'm going to comply with the changes, what Twitter's asking me to do, whatever terms I've accepted when I said I want to use this API, I'm going to comply with. But for example, the Android example, I think, is a good one. In Android, you have a sort of a built-in share menu, right? You can tap something and say, share this to email, share this to messaging. That's a social action if you interpret that very broadly. You know, is Twitter really going to – am I going to take that – for example, menu, am I going to disable that menu on tweets? Because if you interpret this guideline very, very strictly, you know, Twitter might ban the app. No, of course not. I'm going to leave it in there. And if Twitter calls me out on it, then I'm going to pound my fists and say that they've gone evil.
You know, I'm going to go back to your point about democracy. I it's not a democracy. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. But Twitter has to acknowledge publicly that it depends upon you developers. And I think that they did at the beginning. I was at a conference where Biz Stone was asked, along with Chad Hurley and Reid Hoffman, by a Wall Street guy, what big company do you want to do a deal with? They looked at them like they were confused German shepherds with their heads cocked. They said, why would we do that? No, our users and our developers distribute us. We rely on our ecosystem. It's a member of an ecosystem. And let me just do this real fast. But when I wrote the post, I tried to come up with some rules for platforms, right? The first, I think, is that users come first. If you don't believe in that, then you're creating a walled garden. You're creating a service. Hey, use it or lose it. We don't care. It's like a telephone company. Second, a platform is defined by its users. If it's truly a platform, you don't necessarily know how everyone will use it. Only through its use do you learn what it is. The platforms collaborate. If you don't collaborate, it's a dead thing. A platform changes. And the platforms need principles. That a platform, I think, should be transparent. It should enable portability. These are principles. And that it has to be reliable. If you can't rely on it, if you cannot trust it to be what you think it is going to be, if you can't rely on it to at least be transparent about its changes, then is it really a platform? Now, is Twitter a platform then? Or is it becoming AOL? People always say, oh, Facebook is the next walled garden, the next AOL. Is Twitter trying to become the next AOL?
Can you be a platform for people but not a platform for developers?
I don't think so, because I think people are developers. Even if you don't write code, right? The people who put in hashtag or @ in Twitter.
That's true.
But they're not absolutely disenfranchised.
True. People would use it.
So, in other words, people are – I would submit that these API changes affect developers. And so Twitter might be saying, we don't want to be a platform for developers. We want to be a platform for people.
For users, okay. For people, for Justin Bieber fans. Yeah. And it's less about power users and developers and more about regular people.
That's not unreasonable. Is it?
Right. In fact, a lot of these changes, you know, empower regular users, right? So the, you know, getting your app certified, you know, apps that come pre-installed on devices must be certified. The display requirements are going to, those things are going to reduce confusion,
right?
And you know, make a consistent experience, right? Which is what Sippy's last blog post headline was, creating a consistent user experience for regular people. I mean, I think this is just the tech community reckoning with the fact that Twitter isn't for the elites anymore.
Not ours anymore. We got app.net. Pay $100 and join app.net if you want to.
Right.
Learn.
I mean, that's, or has I think been that's called, part of it.
Yeah.
I have $50.com. I think was the thing. What, was,
so
the, what was the mockery?
Yeah.
So
something
funny.
Like that. Yeah. But I mean, seriously, if the tech community wants, there's plenty of places the tech community can go. Twitter is pretty much saying we want to be for real people, we want a business model. And I don't think real people know or care about APIs, $50, stewardship, platforms, or anything else.
Do you think regular people are seeking out non-Twitter clients? I mean, regular people are typing Twitter into the App Store search box, right? They're not typing in boy.
No, they don't even have to because it comes with the iPhone.
Oh, right.
And that's what Twitter wants, by the way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Twitter
do
doesn't.
Now, but
yeah.
But Twitter built itself on the back of those developers.
Yeah,
but
that was a mistake. And that was my question is, should Twitter have thought of this earlier?
could Twitter be what Twitter is without those developers? I would argue absolutely not.
No, I agree,
Twitter
too.
Twitter without the at sign would be useless. Twitter without the hashtag would not allow people to organize revolutions.
And all of that came from third parties, not from Twitter.
Absolutely. Twitter's not smart. Twitter's smart, but it's not smart enough to have built Twitter.
But putting myself in Twitter's shoes, I would say, well, that's true, but now we need to survive. We need to monetize. And we need to be a less confusing, more consistent platform for the real people who are using us. That was then, this is now.
And don't develop on it.
Right, and don't develop on it. We'll take it from here.
Yeah.
Is it immoral or dishonorable to have built a company on developers' backs and 5 years later to say, hey, you know, it's that's nice, thanks. If we've got enough clients. They're not saying to tap bots, don't make Tweetbot anymore. They're just saying no more new ones. Although
they're saying you can make it, but you know, at 100,000 user right. tokens, you're going to have to talk to us if you right. want to go beyond that.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I'm not defending Twitter by any means, but I think I understand what they're saying. My question is it wrong? Is it bad? Should they not be doing
it? It's hubristic. It's thinking that they can go it alone now. And yeah. it's a bit weaselly in that it rejects a community that made them what they are.
They're
saying we got this, yeah. right? So the reason why Twitter was built on the backs of developers, really, it was users making up new conventions like at replies and retweets, and independent developers being faster than Twitter proper to make clients to support those things, because Twitter proper was so small and unproven and was just dealing with stopping the fail whale every day,
exactly.
right? But now Twitter's got the infrastructure and the team and the clients, and they're basically saying, we got this. Any new traditional client feature we can handle. We're building cards. We're innovating kind of internally. So we got this. You guys do the other stuff. So it is a little bit of hubris.
Here's the analog. OS 10 is built on an open source kernel, mock kernel, and BSD. So they built up. Now they never made Apple never made a promise to that community, and they made a little bit of a promise. We'll give back Darwin. Blah blah blah. But they're built on IMDb, CDDB. There are many. CDDB is actually the most accurate analog, which was a database of CD information that was created by users, at which went basically private. And they said, okay, we got it from here. It happens a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm. So is it immoral? Is it unethical
that's
for
the
a
question.
Company to grow? And change?
especially if you accept the premise that they couldn't survive. I think that's the crux of it. Did they have to do this? Is it greed or was it necessity?
We don't know because they really haven't told us.
Yeah. And Dan
What's
Frommer says it was necessity.
What's the downside of... So I guess the downside is we must put ads in tweets, and if those ads don't appear...
Right.
I wrote another post this last week, trying to rethink copyright. Not that I'm hardly the first one doing that. There's millions of people trying to rethink it. But it occurs to me that there's a notion of what I call credit right, the right to a credit, the right to move things on, and that creates new models. And so I saw a company I might have mentioned last week called Repost.us. Did I mention them?
Mm.
That enables an article to become embeddable. So I wanted to build this because no one would build it, but luckily along came a company that did it, and it's really very cool that an article could travel and be embedded like a YouTube video with brand advertising, your own advertising, the creator's analytics, and the creator's links associated with it. So rather than trying to get everybody to come to your site, which is the old media model, now you can go to where the readers are. And what that has embedded in it is the business model. That says, yeah, you need advertising and analytics to travel with your content. If it's going to travel anyway, let's take advantage of that and leap on top of it. So, you know, I argue that, yes, the creator has some rights to create those rules by which this can happen. So is Twitter right to say we think these buttons have to travel with the stuff that we've created? Okay. The only thing yes, but there is not one shred of content was on Twitter was made by Twitter. Was made by its users. And so we asked Gina, is it a democracy or not? No, it's not. But it should act a little bit more like one with an acknowledgement that if we left tomorrow, and this is why Google says don't be evil, not because they're virtuous, but because being evil is really bad business now. Is this evil? No, I think it Weasley is as high as I'll go.
Okay.
Evil would be saying to Justin Bieber, hey, we can't afford you because we have to do five extra servers just for your content. So could you rate limit your tweets? Or evil might be saying you can only have 1.5 million followers.
Or we'll charge you for more.
Or well, I don't know if that's evil, actually. That might make more sense. Maybe that's what's next. I don't know.
Well, I guess that's what App.net would argue, yeah.
Yeah.
Crappy is saying you can only retrieve 3,200 of your own tweets from the service.
Has that slowed down growth of Twitter? And that's been the case all along since almost the beginning. Has that slowed down the growth of Twitter at all?
No. If a platform doesn't adhere to certain principles, it does not necessarily slow down growth, right? If you make a great product, which Twitter has, you get huge adoption, which they have, you know?
Yeah.
So you have
Twitter's looking at the number of people they have on Twitter, and they're saying we're doing everything right. Now we just need to figure out a way to make money.
On the question of how tweets are displayed, you know, it's interesting, Jeff, like you're saying, this is our content, so Twitter shouldn't dictate the way that tweets are displayed. But if apps, I mean, who should decide how tweets are displayed? App makers?
That's exactly the right question, Gina. Yeah, I don't know. All I'm saying is that, yes, Twitter does have a right to say this, but it's not an exclusive right. It's not a right that goes beyond the interests of its users. And so if there are apps that come down the pike that I as a user would like to exist, we users would like to exist, but they now can't because Twitter exclusively said, no, you can't do that for reasons that they have, that's Weasley behavior to its users. See rule number one, a platform is its users. In the end of the day, a platform without users is not a platform.
Right.
It's nothing.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. It's a platform for users now. Thank you, app developers. It's not a platform for
but
you.
The user, but what has Twitter become? Twitter became what Twitter became because developers.
Yeah, but it's Gina done.
That's the real question, Leo. Is it done? Is Twitter baked now?
It's baked. Yes, it's baked. You see, you see Twitter hashtags on every television show. It's done. Thank you. We'll take it from here. I admit, you know, I'm believing you danced with the one that brung you, but I can understand why they might say, hey, you know, we've got investors. The ones that brung them are the people that put $150 million into Twitter's infrastructure.
That's what made Yahoo. Yahoo thought it was baked. Google never thought it was baked.
Interesting.
I'll tell you, the couple of apps that I'm really concerned about, given these guidelines, TimeHop. You guys have used TimeHop? I think we talked
about
it here.
Apes TimeHop. I love it.
Yeah, so they email you a year ago tweets.
They're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, well, even if they comply with the display requirements, they just add a new feature where you can comment on and ask somebody. Like, so if I get your year ago tweet, I can ask for an explanation. I can be like, hey, Leo, like, what did this mean? But that's a comment on another service, you know, a third party service. So I'm worried about that one. And I'm worried about Stellar.io, which Jason Kaki makes, which is kind of like a list of all your friends' favorite tweets. It's awesome. There's always great content there. And it's favorites across several networks, Flickr, YouTube, et cetera. But Jason's a designer and he put a lot of thought and work into making tweets, you know, to making the reading experience really nice and being really minimal about what meta information he shows in every tweet. And if for him to comply with the display requirements, it's going to add all the little Twitter glitter, you know, the retweet button, the reply button, the favorite button, the avatar and all that. So I'm concerned. I want to be clear with everyone that I am concerned about these changes. And I think it's going to, you know, affect some apps that are even not traditional Twitter clients badly. And I'm really hoping that Twitter is going to take that Facebook approach of like break things and then kind of, you know, break things fast and then fix them later. I'm hoping that Twitter is going to iterate on these changes and maybe clarify some of the guidelines or requirements and maybe be a little more lenient than the worst interpretation. And that's just a hope. And we're going to see these changes roll out in the next few weeks, the coming weeks.
You know,
I agree, Gina. And I've made a mistake before. I'm going to emphasize this again. I've made a mistake before thinking that Twitter took a wrong turn when it took right turns. And I'm not saying that these are absolutely wrong terms. I may not understand. So the problem here may be a problem of communication and transparency, or it may be a problem of culture and substance. I don't know yet, but I want to know.
Yeah, I do too.
I'm just sad because besides using ThinkUp to archive my tweets, I've been using a WordPress plugin for years that automatically archives my tweets. And I put there's a blog post every week. I don't think anybody ever reads it because there's never any comments on it. But on my blog, there's a post every Sunday night of my Twitter updates for the week. And it's as much for me to be able to look back at that week, you know, 10 years from now, because Twitter's not going to let me do that. So these are all archived. I mean, I don't think Twitter's going to notice this plugin, but if they do, this is clearly a violation of their right.
Because yeah, that definitely those don't comply.
There's
to
no
the
reply. There's no tweet.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a pure case of this being your content.
It's my content being archived from Twitter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You should be able to display your tweets on your blog however you want.
In any way you want.
Yeah, I wrote it. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I guess if there were a lot of people like me who really thought that was important, that could hurt Twitter. But I suspect that that's not the case. It's just
that goes into reading Twitter's TOS, because are you granting Twitter a non-exclusive license of that content, in which case you're just exercising your own use of that of your content?
Well, and this is what I've always said, is that for years, and it's why I keep quitting Twitter. I am the number one Twitter quitter, as I have been for years. In fact, we were going over on app.net all of the places that I have left Twitter for, starting with Jaiku, remember that? And right. Counts and Plurk and Buzz. And I can go on and on. I keep because I want somewhere that will treat my and StatusNet or Identica. I want somewhere that will treat my content as my content.
Someone in the Simple Panda says, "Don't forget Spelunk." Is that actually?
I don't think there's a Spelunk. Okay, there could be. I don't know. I like Jaiku. You know, Google bought them, put them out of their misery. I guess you can open source the code though. Code's open source. You could make your own Jaiku server because it had Threaded. It was everything Twitter wasn't, but it didn't make it. And that's really the bottom line. Now, was it the developers that made? I guess it was. It was developer ecosystem that made Twitter Twitter. Why didn't Pounce succeed? Pounce was great. Why didn't Jaiku succeed?
Was it because they came after Twitter?
Maybe the network effect, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all critical mass, and when you hit critical mass, then the rules change.
Something changed on Twitter when Ashton Kutcher and Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber, when the celebrities discovered it, that was when they turned the corner, right? Britney Spears.
Yeah, I mean that was a big part of it, I think.
And that to me was the first reason to get the hell out of there. As soon as Ashton Kutcher was there, it's like, I don't want to be here. Unfortunately, that's where everybody is. I don't know. It's fascinating. I like app.net.
It is.
I don't think app.net's going to make a difference.
No.
Yeah, but I really like where Jeff is poking at right now, which is like what makes a platform a platform?
Right.
What should the principles of a platform be? You know, what things out there really are platforms what are just kind of media companies. I know you don't know, but that's what I like about this is that
that's what this show was kind of about, really, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The cloud is really possible because platforms, networks, the way I draw the world now on the whiteboard is that you had vertically integrated industries that are now replaced by three levels. Platforms, entrepreneurial efforts that can start now because those platforms exist, and then networks that are necessary oftentimes to bring those entrepreneurial efforts to critical mass. For things like purchasing or audience.
And the network really is just a special case of platform.
Right. That's true. And value today falls to the platforms because that's who has it together. So Google and Twitter and so on. I think it starts to shift over time. So I've been arguing that newspapers should think of themselves as platforms for their communities. Universities should think of themselves as platforms for students' futures and education. Governments should be platforms. Tim O'Reilly, if he shows up, will probably talk about that.
That's what Government 2.0 is all about.
So in that case, it means – and you have people like Yochai Benkler who do brilliant work about networks and what networks are. But I think the network kind of exists in an ecosystem on its own. They form like atoms into molecules. A platform is an explicit act to create something that people use and thus depend upon to build something. Benefits come from that. Huge benefits flow. That if you become a platform that makes critical mass, you get huge benefit once you figure out your business model. But responsibilities also flow. So that's what I'm trying to get at, Gina, is I'm trying to understand what we should expect those responsibilities to be. And can we ever depend upon them? Or you know, Siva Vaidnathan and I will argue about whether Google has to be evil because it's a company. I don't think all companies have to be evil. I think today, you know, it's bad business to be evil. But maybe we can't depend on platforms. Maybe it's fool's Aaron, to ever depend on platforms because they must be what they must be, which is companies, and they will change.
Unless they're open source, which is why I like open source.
Which is okay, so if you can build. So then the other question that came about Twitter, could you really, and I forget who wrote about this, so I apologize for not citing, but someone, not me, wrote that, okay, smart asses, you think you want a Twitter to be federated, but what if the tweets ended up coming, you know, 10 minutes or 10 days later? You have a high,
worthless.
You have a low tolerance for,
worthless, yeah.
And so you and witness the fail whale. So you want a company to run this. Once a company runs it, folks, then the rules change again.
I think some of this comes down to your definition of platform. And this is what I was trying to get at was the traditional definition of platform is an operating system as a platform. Microsoft created, in fact, you could really say that Microsoft created the platform that powered the personal computer industry for many, many years because it provided a reliable, stable API and service platform for developers to use. It was those apps on top of Microsoft Windows that made it all work. To my mind, that's one kind of platform. But I think we're seeing the emergence of a second kind of platform. And that's kind of the point I was making, which is Twitter was originally like Windows, that kind of a platform, a developer platform. But they quickly realized that really what they are is a platform for users, a content platform. And that's I don't think the rules are the same for a newspaper as platform as they are for an operating system as platform. I think the rules are different.
But I go back to that notion of, Gina brought it up, you know, the RT. That the fact that it was users were not developers, but they acted like developers. They created a function through they added to the API. They added a convention.
Yeah.
And Gina, what do you think a platform is?
Well, I mean, a platform enables users, enables people to get things done, right? So, it's interesting. I mean, I think that question that you and Siva talked about is whether or not if a company is in charge of a platform, do the rules change? I mean, is Twitter's goal to be a platform? Is Twitter's goal to stick around and provide a great service? You know, I mean, I think about the iOS App Store, right, as a platform. That's a platform for developers to sell their apps. And it's Apple's rules. It's not an open deal.
And this is the point Marco makes. For a platform to be successful for developers, it has to be consistent.
Yes,
that's what Twitter's not been. You need Microsoft succeeded as a platform, particularly Microsoft, because it never changed the API. It never changed the rules. It was really consistent. And
it controlled the rules, but you didn't have to get approval. But you didn't have to get approval to come up with a product.
And I don't know if approval is a disadvantage or not. As long as the environment is known and stable, as it is with the app platform on iOS, I don't think it's a matter. Control is really the issue. It's that we want to be. It has to be consistent. That's what Marco was saying.
He was saying the inconsistency freaked him out. That he felt like if these changes are being launched now, what happens next year or the year after? Do we really think that the App Store has been totally consistent? I mean, haven't there been enough? No. Sort of App Store snafus this whole time. And it also is just Apple's nature to be very controlling. They're the whole widget company, right?
Right.
I mean, Apple's never going to build something on top of an open platform. They want to control the whole experience top to bottom, and they've been very successful, you know, doing that. And, you know, when they launched the iOS platform, they're also a multi-billion-dollar company. Twitter was a tiny little startup and would have done anything to get anybody to use it, including developers in the beginning. And that's why they made an API that was totally insecure. I mean, remember when you could pass your username and password along the URL?
Yes.
Access the API. I mean, they made it just so easy for anybody. And that's why some developers loved it. I mean, I think tons of web developers really cut their teeth on API development on the Twitter API because it was so easy. And so they went from very, very liberal to more restrictive, and people don't respond well to that, right? But if you're Apple and you start very restrictive and you set the tone, this is what it is, then, you know, you feel more secure. You know, Marco obviously feels that Apple's been very consistent. This whole time, I don't know. I mean, things change. I feel like things have changed in the App Store as well. I mean, there's uncertainty about everything. Whenever you're building something on someone else's business that relies on someone else's business, there's risk. I mean, there's risk when you cross the street, you know?
But that's, again, this is why consistency is so important. You have to make, you know, it's. I don't think it's a problem. Jeff, you seem to think it was a problem if a platform's owned by a company.
I'd agree with Siva that
it has to be. Because it has to be a dictator. A platform is ultimately a dictatorship because otherwise it's inconsistent. And so it has to be absolutely consistent.
But it's a collaborative.
Well, it's a mix, isn't it? You have to provide a platform means. stable. I can build on this. If it's a moving, shifting sand, it's not stable. It's not a platform. A platform doesn't move. That means it's a dictatorship. Now, you can do all sorts of loopy things on top of it, but
Linux
that platform... Well, that's the... that's why I think Microsoft is probably better at making platforms than Linux was.
And Apple... too.
But even Linux is somewhat of a dictatorship. I mean, Linus was smart enough to say it's not Linux unless I say it's Linux.
Oh, right. I mean, open source, yeah. The key part of successful open source projects is a benevolent dictator, but right. A dictator indeed.
Right.
And, you know, Apple introduced the Mac App Store. I mean, I have to buy my apps through the Mac App Store a certain way, and now they're building into OS X ways to say, oh, this app hasn't been verified. I haven't installed the latest update yet, but, you know,
no, it
this
does.
differentiating between official Apple apps and then Apple app, you know, apps that you just download off the web. I mean, they've gotten more restrictive over time as well. I mean, I think there's just a lot of uncertainty around Twitter in general because people still don't understand how they're going to make money and what they really are, and they're sort of indicating that they're not really sure what they are, and their communications, as we've said,
which is okay. I mean, again, Google shifted. I don't have any objection to that at all. People have joked about, and I've joked about to Fred Wilson's face about you know, oh, Twitter now has a business model 10 times. I think everybody would understand that. Everyone would say, listen, this is the reality. This is the path we're taking. You may not like it. You may think advertising is corrupting or whatever, but it's the way we're going to go. And I'm cool with that. I just think there's a cultural issue there of communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all the worse when you hit that point of critical mass when you think you don't need your developers anymore. That's what's weaselly about it. And if you say, no, we still do, or we still do in some extents, but in some cases we don't because we can't afford to. And here's why. Here's the reality we have. I'd respect it a lot more.
I think that's fair.
I think a great conversation. We're going to move on, but...
That was fun.
I think this is kind of really key. Not just, it's not about Twitter at all.
No. This is what this show is really about. When Gina said the rule day one is it's not. Gina, as I understood, said to you, "I'll be on it if it's not really a show about."
It's not. It's never been a show about Google.
It's a show about the cloud, and what it really is about is platforms and networks and all that. The cloud is just one substantiation of.
Yeah, and I think that the conversation about the conversation about what a platform is, what the rights and responsibilities are of a platform maker, is fundamental to everything we love in technology. I don't care if it's an operating system or a semiconductor or any of that stuff. Instagram, we haven't talked about that since we convened last week. Are we in a bubble? $1 billion. Jeff Jarvis, why would Facebook pay $1 billion for an iPhone app, basically?
They've got it.
They got the money.
The arguments are many that they needed mobile, they needed better photo, that they needed the audience, that they were scared of it because they see themselves, Facebook sees itself, I think perhaps too much as a photo service, but so much of their usage is photo, right. and Instagram was better. As someone said in one of the clips I think today, you know, $1 billion for crappy filters. You know, I'm not an Instagram fanatic at all. I hardly use it ever.
I love Instagram. And I used it a lot. When it first came out, I was a big early supporter of Instagram.
And that's what they purchased for $1 billion. They purchased your
30 million me's.
Yes, exactly. And I just wrote a column about this, which is going to go live any second now. There are basically three things that Facebook got out of this that they didn't already have. I mean, don't tell me about users because most Instagram users also use Facebook and it's only 35 million people versus 800-900 million.
Right.
So they didn't buy users. They didn't really buy technology. There's no technology in Instagram that's worth a damn. I mean, I don't mean to
steal
disparage.
It all.
It's pretty good design, but it's a free app with cheesy filters that's really easy to use and clean, but people love it.
Right.
They love Instagram and people don't love Facebook. People love to use Facebook
right.
because the people that they love are on Facebook. But you'll never hear the phrase Facebook fanboy.
Right.
Nobody's a fan of Facebook.
No, that's true.
And big companies can't engineer affection unless you're Apple. I think this is the beginning of a trend where companies will be purchased and highly valued because they've been able to engender super high user affinity. And that's what Instagram is. It's they're buying the love of they're not only buying the love of 30, 35 million people, but they're buying the ability to be lovable. And I think a lot of this, a lot of the Instagram pixie dust is going to end up in their mobile apps. And the hope is that it will make people love Facebook more.
So they're buying a soul. This is from Paul's New Yorker piece. He said that basically Facebook is buying soul. The soul of a startup, a thing that people just love.
Can you really buy that, though? Don't you kill it when you buy it?
That's a good question, Leo. I tend to think no. I mean, I saw a lot of people write a lot of pieces about how to export all your photos from Instagram and close your account once they heard about, you know, the Facebook acquisition.
But you know what, Gina? That's what got me pissed off. Mm-hmm. There's this digisnob movement that as soon as Facebook touches it, well, I'm going to kill it.
Right.
You know, 845 million people against you. I mean, how out of touch are you with what's going on? How uncurious are you about what, you know, the world is using? Kill it. I don't care. But to make this announcement that I'm going to unsubscribe to you, or I'm going to kill this account, or I'm going to do that, I don't care. The business is still growing. It doesn't, frankly, need you. If there's too many of you, that's true. But this idea that Facebook has cooties, I think it's kind of ridiculous. Facebook may well ruin it. You know, everything that AOL bought, everything that Yahoo bought got ruined. But Zuckerberg does do things differently. And he said in his message, it was very important, that he plans to keep this running independently. He still wants it to be part of an ability in the ecosystem to send to other services. I don't think this is the creation of a unified social network. I think it's the creation of the first social conglomerate.
Well, you know, note that he said that he would keep it running separately, but he didn't say that we're not going to make Facebook more like this also.
That's okay.
But back to the point, I think that you can actually purchase love like this, because the reason people love Instagram is because of how it makes them feel. Instagram, people love their lives. They love their cat, their friends. They see a sunset. They're inspired by it. They want to share it. It's a human impulse to want to share the things that you're inspired by. And Instagram lets you go snap, make it a little arty. So I feel like I'm being expressive and creative, even though I'm not.
Right.
And then click a button and everybody sees it.
Yeah, it's Mike.
But it feels really good to people.
But okay. But I think that love is hard to earn and easy to lose. And and I don't say that because of the cootie aspect. Oh, Facebook touched it. But look at Flickr. I think people love Flickr. Yahoo bought it. I still use Flickr. I use Flickr a lot. But Yahoo abandoned it. So my love for Yahoo was diminished. Not that I ever had any possible respect I had for Yahoo, put it that way, was diminished by their abandonment of Flickr. And Delicious, worse.
Right.
So you can't buy it. You can at most borrow it.
Yeah. The other thing I think that I haven't heard very many people mention is that one reason to purchase Instagram is to prevent them from supporting Google Plus. Because right now it supports everything but Google Plus, like a lot of things.
So buy them before there's a right API.
Exactly.
And yeah. Because
you know, I mean, when you take a picture here, we'll do this real quickly. We'll take a picture of Gina because I think that's the best thing to take a picture of.
Aww.
And then I will make it arty.
I read somebody say that, you know, these filters make everything look like it was taken in the 70s.
Right. And now I can share as Twitter, Facebook, email, Flickr, Foursquare, Tumblr, Posterous.
Everything but.
Where's the Google? Where's the Google? Yeah. And for a couple of things come to mind. First of all, I don't think that the naysayers are really important. I mean, after all, when there was an Android version of Instagram, it was probably the same people who said, "Ew, you got Android in my iPhone." So those people are probably just, you know, they're not going to make a big difference. But I wonder, can you inject, you know, when they're making biogenetically enhanced products, they inject DNA. Can you inject DNA from Instagram into Facebook? Or I think Facebook's a juggernaut. I think there's only 30 people work at this, or 20 people that work at this company. How is that going to change the monster that is Facebook.
Well, to your point, how did the acquisition of FriendFeed change Facebook?
It didn't.
I mean, does anybody remember FriendFeed? Yeah. It was the flavor of the month, and then Facebook bought it and right. just kind
and
of
Brett Taylor crashed. who came from FriendFeed became Facebook's CTO.
Yeah. Wasn't FriendFeed bought? I thought FriendFeed was bought. FriendFeed was the Walking Dead at that point.
Yeah, they were bought for the people, and this is in yeah. fact up till now. Good. Everything Facebook's done is an acquire.
Right.
That doesn't work in audio. It only works when you write it. AQUHIRE. Where they would get, I'm thinking of Sam Lesson of Dropio, which was a great product, and yeah. they killed it because all they yeah. really wanted was Sam.
Right.
FriendFeed was a dying product, but they really yeah. just wanted Paul and Mike. Obviously, they mostly wanted Brett. This is going to be different, I think.
I think this is more like Maps, isn't it? I mean, this is more like Google buying the folks who made it a
Maps. Big part of Facebook.
Because you look what they did with Sam. So I think Sam's a good example, right? So by hiring Sam, by buying his company, he became key to mm-hmm.
He did Timeline.
And the best thing that can happen here is that, yes, Instagram can exist on its own. But I think you're right, Mike. The point is that Facebook becomes more like Instagram rather than Instagram becomes like Facebook.
Those 20 people, and it's really not 20, it's really probably Kevin Systerman, nobody else. If he can go in, I guess Sam did. Brett
Sam
did. I guess
open
you're
to
right.
that kind of culture, yeah. and they hired those other guys who were involved in Timeline. They went and hired the brightest they could. I think right. that's part of what Zuckerberg tries to do. He walks them through the woods to convince them to come there because it's part of kind of the cult of Zuck. And I think that means something. That's part of what they pride themselves on Facebook is that they're not the behemoth that Google has become.
Cult or not, if anybody offered me $1 billion for anything, including my firstborn, I think I'd really consider it anyway.
Cleared 3 days before this announcement, who got a piece of that $1 billion, who doubled their money in 3 days.
Yeah.
That's what's really absurd.
Yeah.
Through the lottery, man.
Hey, you just got to know where you're investing. That's all. Systrom, the founder, got $400 million. The investors, of course, made out like bandits. And in fact, they had a $100 million pool that's divided among the remaining employees. So each of them is going to be a millionaire. This is
the thing about the acquisition announcement that made me kind of crazy. Or this is the thing that fascinated me or maybe galled me a little bit is, it's like 20-year-old guy gets a $1 billion exit. It has such a huge impact on the technology community, the tech media, and then I think the startup community, because suddenly the whole conversation becomes about
how can I get my
billion?
Who
had the most yeah. spectacular exit? Right. There's all this like weird jealousy, and there's kind of the Facebook backlash, and then I just think you have a lot of young people who are trying to make good products on the web, which is what we're all supposed to be trying to do, not trying to have the most spectacular $1 billion exit possible. Kind of get distracted.
It is distracting.
You know?
Yeah.
Gina, I think you're way right. And I think that this creates a 1% of the technology world.
Yes, it does.
And that's part of the problem where we are now. And it skews the ethical view. If it skewed banking, it's going to skew geeks too. And it's worrisome that's where we are. Now, I don't begrudge them getting the money they can get. God bless them. But yeah. you're right. What does it do to the rest of the world around them?
There's this very small contingent of young men, young white men who have a lot of money because they had, they won this lottery. And like you said, good for them. It makes me sad that then the conversation about web product development, becomes about the exit and not about, making something really good. And I think Instagram.
This has been going on since 1994 and Netscape.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is frankly always the undercurrent in Silicon Valley are you going to make
like
the big
this.
Score?
I like this trend because essentially years ago, if you were a young entrepreneur, you wanted to go for that big payoff either by becoming a company with a lot of revenue or by selling to a larger company. That's always been the case. But in the past, you had to always demonstrate – well, not in the past. Since the crash of 2000, you had to demonstrate that you had a business plan. This is the revenue model. This is how we can make money. And these guys never got around to that part of it. They just created
a
free app that everybody loved. And I would love to see everybody focused on creating things that everybody loves and stop trying to figure out how we can.
With you, Mike. I think sustainability matters. I see that disease in journalism and news and media where people say, I just want to do what's cool and neat, and they don't put any thought into sustainability. And so then what happens, this is where the true bubble comes in. Then they say, well, okay, I'll get bought. And they don't give any thought to it, which is really just a bad way to create a feature. There's no reason. You know,
but isn't that what it is?
Yeah, it is. But here's the issue. What we should be critical of is not the makers of, I think, Instagram. We should be critical of Facebook,
right?
That they have a structure that meant that rather than developing something cool and nice in-house, they had to go buy for $1 billion, something wrong there. The other thing is, I really want to go back to what Gina said, because I think it's important, that we have to look at the future financial structure of our world. And I've argued, and I argued this in a post about the jobs bill, not jobs, but J-O-B-S, the investment, which I'll talk about in a second, that we're moving from a world of vertical industries fully owned where you control product creation, manufacturing, marketing, and distribution to a world of ecosystems. And the ecosystems, I say that there are three layers. There's a platform layer. There's an entrepreneurial layer now made possible by the platform layer existing. And there's a network layer that is often necessary to get those small entrepreneurial ventures to critical mass. Okay, what's happening in our world today is all the value is falling to the platform. That's why Google is worth so much and Facebook and so on and Zynga. The entrepreneurial layer is possible to do because those platforms exist, but you're small. You're inevitably small until maybe you get in a network like Glam. What I like about the jobs bill, apart from taking away regulation that we probably still do need on companies because companies and Wall Street are all screwed up, but the idea of being able to get funding to new ventures on their own now easier than going through venture capital from crowdfunding, and the idea of being able to exit without having to sell out for $1 billion or go IPO, and you can get earlier exits and get some value out of this, I hope drives some value back up to the entrepreneurial layer, which is the one that Gina really loves and I love and that we want to encourage. If the only way we encourage that is the absolute long shot blockbuster economy, it becomes like Hollywood. A few people will make the movie to succeed, and the rest will starve.
Okay, Instagram did it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jeff. Instagram did everything right, and it's great that they're being rewarded. They had a very lean operation. No, I understand that. But
neither is Gina. I think Gina, right? You're not criticizing them. You're criticizing the structure that this is leading to.
But the $1 billion, the unusual $1 billion purchase price, the radically unexpected, is a reward for having done everything right. If this had never happened, Instagram would have still been very, very successful. There's 10 ways they could have been very successful.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the only gauge. You can also be Mark Cuban, who basically did nothing and got a huge amount of money from a very stupid company that in turn then turned around what they bought for $5 billion. Mm-hmm. And you know, the fact that you got a lot of money is not necessarily the reward of quality. What Gina, I think, is going to, and I want to hear back from Gina, is that I think that there's an ethic that you want to see rewarded, right, Gina?
Yes.
And it's got to be more than just, oh, I made something nice. It's got to be that I can have a sustainable business out of this. I can raise funds to do it. I can take some money off the table to buy my house. I can make something good and be good and have a business. And we want lots of that happening rather than a few blockbusters. Gina, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I my last trip to New York, I visited a startup. I won't say which one, but it's been in business for almost 10 years. It's profitable, doing great. And the founder said to me, you know, I feel just so old and slow. Like when you look at things like Zynga, and I bet now, you know, or OMG Pop, and I bet now he'd say Instagram. And it was like, wait a second, 10 years in business, you know, with a profitable internet business, media company on the internet, that's something to be proud of. That's something to celebrate. I only hope that, you know, 10 years, my company will still be around and I'll still be passionate about it and I'll still be doing meaningful, interesting things on the web and I will have made something that people love. You know, I listen, Instagram's an awesome app. I loved it. They made an incredible product experience. Those guys did a great job and good for them and their $1 billion. It makes me sad that it kind of sets up this goal or this standard, you know, that people are like, well, if I don't, you know, if I don't build this blockbuster product in 2 years, by the time I'm 26 and sell out for $1 billion, then I failed.
Well, they should. Good. Listen to Gina, entrepreneurs. You haven't failed.
Yeah.
You haven't failed. You built something good. And you know what? Most people, like 99.9%, will never have a big payday like Kevin's sister had. This is really an outlier.
That's the goal, Leo. That's the problem.
It can be the goal. And you know why it's good? Because what it does is it gets everybody on Page Mill Road to start putting money into lots of little startups.
But, Okay, but that, but yeah, but that's part
that's
of the
not
issue
why it's
is,
good.
Is that they expect that kind of their definition of failure is not
they,
the definition.
They know that there it's a long shot, but it means no, but there's more money to invest because there's more money to be made. Most entrepreneurs are like me, where I'm just going to be happy if I could survive a year or two and make a profitable business. That's the way most people think. I don't think it's going to change how people feel.
I'm going to go wonky for a second. I read a great book I just blogged about called The Institutional Revolution. It's pretty wonky. No Gutenberg in it. But it tries, from an economics perspective, to explain why there were these ridiculous institutions in pre-modern England of the aristocracy and bought army commissions and dueling and private roads.
Right.
And it, really interesting analysis that said before you could measure performance, you had to get trust in other means. You got means in things like he calls a hostage capital. You sent your daughter to the court, and if you screwed up, you couldn't see her again. You made a huge estate because you invested in that. Point is, then other means came along to measure. People could find longitude and latitude. We had clocks that worked. We had measurements. You could measure success in new ways. And so the institutions changed. What Gina is talking about here really, I think, is that we are creating the new institutions of society. The technology industry is creating new institutions and how they operate and under what ethics and mores and with what goals. And we have to stand back and say, if $1 billion becomes the goal, again, God bless Facebook and God bless Instagram. Not complaining about them. But what are we building? What's the society
we want to build a society where all of the above is celebrated and possible and common. And in fact, that's exactly what we have. Lots and lots of small entrepreneurs in technology are building companies and making going concerns of it and doing very well. And it's fantastic. The thing that excites me about these big, splashy billion-dollar payoffs is it's something that inspires high school students to want to become entrepreneurs. Starting a little company and making a nice profit off in the corner doing something is awesome. And
there's
something
few,
that everybody should try to do.
That's like saying,
it doesn't
Mike,
matter if there's few. How many?
It's
how many
the lottery. People buy lottery tickets. Who bought Mega Millions tickets? Everybody. Even my smart
which is an
employees.
Which is a terrible
I agree. But look, I think both entrepreneurs and investors know that this is an outlier. It's the outlier that makes people feel good and say, gee, we could buy, you know, like win the lottery ticket. And I don't see any real harm done here.
You're making the basketball in the ghetto argument, which is that very few can make the pro teams, but if many hope to, then it's good.
Well, in fact, the reality is that a lot of young people think the only way to make it in the world that they either have to become a superstar singer, rap singer, or Beyonce, or something like that, or they have to become a major sports person, or they have to be famous, or nothing.
It doesn't take – no, but we're dealing with a smart class of people. Wait a minute. The tech community is smart. They're not stupid. They know that this is an outlier. They're not – they understand what Gina's saying. You should build a company. You should build value. You should do – you're giving them no credit. They're not – they're smart. They know this isn't – they're not going to get $1 billion. That might happen. It gives them a little hope, a little something to dream about. But almost everybody who starts a company, I would guarantee you, is just trying to make something good. And make something that can last, make something profitable. Yes, we all think about our big exit, but that doesn't change how you do things, does it? I mean, I think you still try to add value.
I hope so. I hope that young entrepreneurs are not aiming for the hockey stick big exit, you know, crazy. I hope that people want to build businesses that last. I just think that stories like this, they get the amount of hype that they do. And, you know, it's $1 billion. It's a big number. I understand. I'm not blaming the media. It seemed like a really big distraction. I mean, at one point I had to close Twitter because I just couldn't, you know, the joking, the snarking, the commentary, the opinions, right.
It gets a lot of attention. By the way, if it had been 900 million, it wouldn't have gotten that much of attention.
It would not.
It's 1 billion that makes such a big deal.
It is. And you know, and my fantasy, and I have no idea how this actually happened, but my fantasy is this, that Facebook went to Instagram and said, okay, we want to buy you for this much. And Instagram said, no way. And they said, we want to buy you for this much. And Instagram said, no way. You cannot afford us. We care about our product too much. Yeah. And it got up to $1 billion, right? Like everybody has their price. And it makes me really happy that Instagram's price is $1 billion. That's great.
I think that's exactly what happened.
That's the price.
You think that's what happened? Yes. That makes me happy.
Because
right?
They, you know, their last round, they were valued at $100 million. Some wild crazy people a few months ago said $500 million.
It's based on the last round. I think the last round was valued at that.
It's clearly more than you would normally. You're not going to say, I'll take $1 billion. You might say it in jest. And then when Mark Zuckerberg says, okay.
Okay. And who's going to go home then and say, honey, I'm proud of myself. I turned down $1 billion today. What? Yeah. To the moon.
That's grounds for divorce.
And now I'm going to get Jeff wired up, round up here, because it's at $1 billion, it's worth $50 million more than the New York Times.
Yes.
The New York Times market cap is $950 million.
A 551-day-old company is worth more than $100 million.
But who has more users?
No, you're right. 30 million is more than whatever, than 1 or 2 million that read the New York Times. I would argue.
No, they have a large online audience.
That's true. Online's bigger.
They actually do have, they probably have more than 30 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what we don't know? This could be a broadcast.com moment. We could be watching Kevin Systrom and the port, jumping onto the floor at the Portland Trailblazers game, making an ass of himself, spending his money like Mark Cuban in 10 years, and everybody will go, remember when Facebook bought, what was the name of his company for like all that money? Whatever happened to that? Okay. No, I'm talking about Instagram. I'm saying 10 years from now.
Oh, right.
Facebook bought, what was that? It was a photo thing.
He'll be on Dancing with the Stars.
I'll tell you who's really feeling bad right now. Do you remember a company called Text America? It was a moblogging company. Had a lot of attention about eight years ago. We were all doing it. We were all taking pictures on our cell phones and putting them on text. It was Instagram. It just was a little too early, and they couldn't make it.
How do you think Hipstamatic feels?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this is timing, right? Timing, connections. I mean, it's talent, but then there's a lot of other factors.
But they tried to monetize.
Right. That was their mistake. So,
No.
Too early. Nothing wrong with monetization, but they clearly
build quality first. Worry about monetization later. Yeah. That's actually okay, Gina, because that fits your model. Because they're not trying to say let's make money right away. Let's build a great product first. Let's build a great community first.
Okay.
As long as we can survive, let's build a great community.
And they were frugal about it. That's the thing. Yeah. It's underappreciated.
For a long time, Instagram was just those two guys. Yeah. I remember we interviewed him. We interviewed Kevin. And we said, where's the Android product? This was a year ago. And he said, it's just the two of us. We don't have time. Yeah. It's just two of us.
Well, my son, Jake thought that actually among his friends, my son Jake, that people were upset about the Android coming out because part of the allure of Instagram was that you had to have an iPhone.
Right.
To have it, and that was part of what made it limited and special.
That's why it was sexy.
Yeah.
So, Paddy Power, who is apparently a very well-known Irish bookie, is taking odds on Facebook's next acquisition, and Foursquare is leading with 4-1 odds. The long odds, MySpace, YouTube is 40-1. Friends Reunited, it's an English,
That's English.
Yeah, so... same thing with a couple
of
these.
That's their classmates.com.
Yeah. Tumblr, 25-1. Spotify, 7-1. I think Spotify should be higher.
I disagree with Evernote being on that list. I don't think they're going to go for Evernote.
9-2 for Evernote.
I agree.
Hey, Jeff, tell us the name of that book because you just held it up so people on video saw it, but we didn't hear it.
Sorry. It's called The Institutional Revolution by Douglas Allen. It's pretty wonky, folks.
Gutenberg. Do you know of any good Gutenberg books?
Yeah, what would be a good book about Gutenberg?
The best Gutenberg, the authoritative one that's out of print is by Albert Kapper, K-A-P-R.
You tried, Mike. Did your best.
Oh.
It's called Gutenberg the Geek, and it's only 99 cents.
Yes, 99 cents.
You tried, Mike.
I walked out. But while we're at it, if you're really into Gutenberg, after having read my thing, you want to read something really good. John Mann's Gutenberg biography is very good.
I will read that. I will read that. I love it.
Facebook is never going to touche.
No, this is why we love Jeff. Well, actually, the best Gutenberg book would be. I'm glad you asked.
All right, Ever the busted.
Professor. Well, no, the only people I want on Twitter, on any of our shows, are people like that. know nothing about promotion or marketing. Jokes. Yeah, we just want to inform. That's all. We're just here
Santa
to
Santa Claus. Go to Gimbel's.
Okay.
Exactly. Also here, Jeff Jarvis, journalism professor from the City University of New York and the author of Public Parts, his newest book. Good to see you,
and
Jeff.
With my hair, I'm always appearing in black and white.
So. You know, you look good in black and white, actually. Also, Matt Cutts is here from Google, one of Google's earliest employees. He works in the spam fighting division at Google and a good person to have on today. Hello, Matt.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining
us. Turning off the logo, do they turn off your lights, Matt?
Yeah, it's a dark day today.
That's fine. Those of you who are just tuning in or downloading the video might be slapping your computer or your television set. No, there's nothing wrong with your set. We are in black and white today because we're recording this on January 18th, which is the day the internet fought back, and with some success, I might add. We just talked to an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation that today alone, 29 members of Congress have reversed their position on the internet. I'm Kevin Purdy, and I thank you for joining. Thank you.
I wasn't quite there yet. Here. I just rolled with it.
I like the black and white, actually. I think it looks kind of good.
Yeah.
There's something about it.
Classy.
So if you go to google.com, there's a nice big, it looks like a piece of duct tape over the logo, and a link. Tell Congress, please don't censor the web. And look at this. Nearly 4 million people today signing that petition. Let me just do that right now so that I can make it 4,000,001. And I encourage everybody while you're watching the show to do that. Matt Cutts, why doesn't Google want to stop piracy? Are you pro-piracy, Matt Cutts?
Of course not. No, we hate piracy. And we actually spend, you know, like $60 million a year trying to get bad ads and other things out of our system. So nobody wants piracy. But it's pretty crazy when you're trying to solve a business model problem with a technological solution that just won't even work. And I think that's one of the big things is people don't realize that pirates will just quickly get around this. And in the meantime, it will absolutely, of course, hurt jobs, but basically put a chilling effect on the internet where a lot of people, a lot of sites that rely on user-generated content will be incredibly affected by it. My wife, I sent her an email and I was like, hey, would you mind calling a senator? And she's like, oh, yeah, I should. And then she went to Craftzine, which is an O'Reilly site, and it was shut down for the day. And she's like, oh, no, that's right. Regular sites are going to be affected. And that was what the tipping point for her to call her senator.
Yeah, I care a lot about this. You know, our news program, Tech News Today, I mean, we get pulled down from YouTube all the time. Our news program, Tech News Today, ran that mega upload or megadownload.com video. Even though that video itself was not an infringing video, but the Universal Music Group decided it was. Universal Music Group also asked Tech News Today to be pulled down. We appealed it. They pulled it down again. We appealed it again. Finally, it was put back up on YouTube. It's funny, Matt, because you do work for the company that owns YouTube, and YouTube has, in many cases, been hand in glove with the music and the recording and the motion picture industry.
Well, what's interesting to me is I went to D.C. last year and did a Q&A, and it was just for staffers. And most places, if you, you know, say, ask me anything about Google, they'll say, how does Google work? You know, how do I rank higher? How do I get my word out to constituents? And I was pretty shocked at how many questions were about YouTube and DMCA and copyright infringement.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Wow.
Yeah. And what I realized is a lot of people have this conception that YouTube is still this, you know, like it was in the very early days where you could find all these shows. And Google has done a very good job of trying to make sure that, you know, if you're the copyright owner, you can make sure the copies are down or you can, you know, monetize it. You've got a lot of different options. So we've worked hard. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. Like with TNT, it's totally the case that you sometimes see overly broad takedowns. You can see mistaken takedowns. You can see takedowns that end up almost looking capricious because it turns out the person didn't have the copyright. We've seen all kinds of fake DMCA requests where people are just trying to hurt either competitors or trying to basically do some prank or something like that. So the notion that this process won't be abused when we already see it abused under DMCA is just crazy.
Yeah. I guess that's the point of that. One of the points of that video that we just aired in, we didn't air it on, I'll tell you what, I'll play it at the end of Twig so you can see it. But it explains why SOPA is bad. And one of the things the video points out is, well, there's a lot of things the video points out, but one of the things the video points out is that there are laws like DMCA and Pro-IP that are already in place. There are anti-counterfeiting laws that can that are more than adequate and have problems already. We don't need to go a step farther. Tim O'Reilly, we're trying to get Tim on. He's in a plane, and when he makes his connection, we're trying to get him on by phone. But he's been really great on Google Plus. A lot of posts on Google Plus. But one of the posts he put up a couple of days ago that I thought was great. Before solving a problem, make sure you've got the right problem. He talks about the unfortunately, the people who framed this debate often frame it around, is it about piracy? But in fact, he says, really, that's a misframed argument. The losses due to piracy are far outweighed by the benefits of the Internet, by the free flow of information. History shows us again and again, frontiers are lawless places, but as they get richer and more settled, they join in the rule of law. American publishing, listen carefully, American publishing, now the largest publishing industry in the world, began with piracy. Began by stealing others' works. He says, we've got to reframe this conversation. Piracy isn't the problem. And even if you thought it was, these bills won't make a difference. Because pirates just go ahead and go around anything like this.
Just earlier this month, where digital sales are now, you know, higher than physical sales of music. And early on, you definitely saw a sort of antagonism towards digital sales by a lot of people in the content industry. And, you know,
just as they hated VCRs, cassettes, MP3 players, freaking piano player rolls.
Yep.
At the turn of the last century, they tried to stop. Player pianos are going to put the music industry out of business.
Leo, I think one of the things that Tim makes so he of all people can make this argument because he is a publisher, he sees the benefits, is that we haven't proven the harm here.
Exactly.
How many of those, and it's proving a negative, how many of those people who did pirate the work would have bought it had they not pirated it? Probably very few. How many people instead, however, did discover the work because it was pirated? Could be very high. And Paulo Coelho, the author, I wrote about this in the last book. He has sold more than 100 million books, yet he pirates his own works.
Right.
Because he discovered that when he put up, when people did pirate his works in other languages like Russian before the book was out, his sales in those countries went up. And he pirated his own works, and his publisher caught him. Jane Friedman caught him because he said, "Oh no, somebody pirated it," and it turned out it was the the
he put it up on Pirate Bay. Paul Coelho did it himself.
Yeah, and it was the wrong version. But he said, "Okay, you caught me, but you know, let's look at the business opportunities here." And you know, Paolo yelled at me. I was giving away books at an event, and he said, "Don't give away books; sell books." You know, so he's very much a salesman, very much believes in it, but he sees the benefit of things being spread in this way. And I think it's the lack of harm, too. And I'm going to start the drinking game early, but you go back to Tim's point about early publishing and Gutenberg. You know, this notion of owning intellectual property is fairly recent in history.
Yeah.
And I think that what's happening, too, is we're going through a phase in society where we're going back to the idea that I just wrote about David Weinberger's magnificent new book, Too Big to Know. And knowledge becomes the network. It doesn't become the property of individuals in it. And that's our old model, and that's the way we used to do this. And I think that this is really about trying to rethink the shape of our world, and that's why the institutions are having such trouble with this. That's why the Rupert Murdochs are belching everywhere.
Look at this tweet from MC Hammer. He says, "Stop SOPA," and there is Hammer with two guys from Firefox standing in front of the Capitol building. I love it.
Nice.
He says, "Need we say more?" So even artists, I think not all artists, but many artists understand that the Internet has given them far more opportunities than it has taken away from them. You say an interesting thing, Jeff, and Tim O'Reilly says this as well. We often conflate, the way the argument's misshapen is we conflate intellectual property with real property. And we think that, you know, steal my phone, that's real property, but steal my idea is not real property and is not protected in the Constitution or by The founders never intended to protect intellectual property. In fact, they said very clearly that the copyright laws and the patent laws were designed to protect the inventor for a limited time, a very limited time, just 14 years, that ultimately that intellectual property was the property of society and belonged to society to promote the arts and sciences. And so this whole idea that somehow something is like that it's real property that's being stolen, even that is fallacious. And
especially in a digital era.
Especially in a digital era.
Not only because it's not a consumable anymore, but also because the models change. And I go through this all the time, but in media, we've been brought up to think that all the value is encased in the product. That's why we sell it. And I've said this, I think, on the show before, but Mark Zuckerberg realizes differently. Content has value, but its value is to get people to generate signals about themselves. Why the hell do you think Google invented Google Plus? Because why is it in Android? Because we're using these things to generate signals about ourselves that allow those services to give us more targeted and relevant content services and advertising and extract more value from their relationships with us. So content does have value, but it's only one value in a chain. And the way media was structured for the 550 years of Gutenberg's era was that content media were encased as a product and could be sold that way. That's just over. So what we're seeing is more than just old companies trying to protect their copyrights. We're seeing right here two important things happening. One is the utter shift of a business model around media. But second, and I'm very, very happy about this, I'm very proud of our internet, we're seeing the beginnings of, I think for the first time, the creation of a public called the net.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, very exciting that this is the first political movement that I believe has started out of the net for the net's concerns, and it's up to this point working. It hasn't won, but it's impressive in what the people of the net can do. So let's remember this, folks, and let's keep fighting for other principles.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, what's going on today is just absolutely historical. What I was going to say earlier, though, I mean, I think that we need to be realistic, though, and accept that we're never going to convince the MPAA and the RIAA that piracy is not a problem. While I agree with you guys, I just think that, they're spending a lot of money convincing the powers that be that piracy is a problem, and this is why we need legislation this way. So what we need to do as a tech community is to educate the government about how the internet works with as much effort and time and human hours as they're spending educating them about how much piracy is a problem. I was at the White House last Monday, which is the reason why I missed the show. I was invited there for a meeting about an event that's happening in the spring, which I'll talk about then. But after the meeting, I had a few moments to speak with Anish Chopra, who's the CTO of the United States. And we were talking about, how does government reach out to its constituents and engage with citizens online? And Anish said, what's the issue of the moment? And I said, absolutely SOPA.
Yay.
And I used, I very strongly advised him that the administration has to put a statement out there.
And they did later. Thank you, Gina.
And he gave a hat tip. What I was very proud of, Gina, he gave the hat tip to you and Twitter, which was really so cool.
He did. Well, I told him that I would boost his follower count by mentioning him on Twitter, which I did. And then said, oh, hey. Hours, you're welcome. And he said, okay. And then when the White House responded.
Gina, say that again because we broke up a little bit. We lost you.
Oh, sorry about that. I had mentioned on him on Twitter saying that tech community should follow him.
Good.
And I think kind of in return he gave me that hat tip for the White House's response. But the White House was working on that response when I was at the White House. So I certainly don't take credit for that.
What's his Twitter handle? I want to follow him.
Anish Chopra. Okay. Anish Chopra is his name, and his Twitter handle is just his name.
A-N-I-S-H?
A-N-E-E-S-H.
C-H-O-P-R-A. All right, I'll follow him right there. There we go. Chief Technology Officer. So, follow. There you go. See? But I do think that this makes an important point, and Scott Fulton writing in Read Web also makes this point. All right. So we've shown we can be negative Nellies and say, don't pass it. But then the challenge is, okay, come up with a solution.
Right. I mean,
but what's the problem, though, Leo?
Well, I agree with you. And this is Neela. And you go back to Twitter about a month ago. Neela Patel and I had a big debate over this. And Neela, who is a lawyer by training, said, you can't just say no. You have to offer a compromise position. My position was digital technologies, there is no technology that effectively prevents piracy. The solution is to reinvent your business model.
Yes.
Not to break the internet and computers. And I do believe that the people who control content today wish computers and the internet would just go away. The reason we chose to go black and white today instead of black entirely is I want to harken back to the 50s, where there was no internet. There was no computer. And, of course, at that time, people, those guys, hated other things. There were other technologies they hated. But they would love computers and the internet to go away. And failing that, they know that's not going to happen. Let's modify them in such a way that we don't have to fear them instead of reinventing their business model. There's plenty of money to be made.
But the problem as they perceive it is that there's piracy going on foreign websites, and the United States needs a way to address that.
Well, is there a way, though?
I don't know. I don't have a better way. I mean, this bill, I mean, this is an attempt to, you know, to give the United States a way to address, there's, you know, foreign website, non-U.S. website offering copyrighted material, which is illegal, and how do we address that? This is not the solution, but what is the solution? I mean, when I brought this up with Anish, he said to me, do you know why this bill even started? It's because we need a way to address, you know, a criminal activity on foreign websites. And it is, listen, offering copyrighted material is a crime right now, right? So what is this?
Gina, hold on there. It's not, what happens in China is not a crime in the U.S., it's a crime in China if China has the right laws.
And in fact, it's not a crime in China. That's part of the problem.
Yeah, so that's what this is trying to do, is to fill in laws and enforcement in lands where it doesn't exist. But we don't have, unless we want to do some, you know, extradition and we've done things like that.
We've got no way of stopping the Chinese. So we'll do what the Chinese did, which is create a great firewall of the United States.
Right, and I agree with Leo here.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, obviously, that's a terrible idea, right? But that's what this Read Write Web article is saying, that the administration is saying, like, okay, if this is a terrible idea, then what can we do?
Okay, here's the idea. Leo is absolutely right, I think, and you start to encourage and teach industries new models. Now, will various of those companies succeed? Not necessarily. You know, the thing that I've been harking about, and I think I've just decided today that we're going to try to build a demo of this at CUNY, is to build embeddable units of content. So I'm going to come back to Google Plus and Richard Gingras and folks, and try to get a Guardian article, let's say, off their API, embedded not only in my blog, but also on Google Plus, with their brand, with their revenue, with their analytics, with links. You change the model. A movie that passes around, maybe it should pass around with advertising in it. And if you want the clean version, you buy it. Otherwise, you get some monetization with it. I don't know. But trying to preserve the old model in a new reality is not the solution, and it is a misstatement. This is where Tim Riley is really so right. It's a complete misstatement of the problem. There's not a proof of harm here. So before we get demanded by the White House or Rewrite Web that, well, okay, then you come up with something better, no, absolutely not. You come up and show us the harm. You show us the real facts that make it worthwhile to ruin the friggin' internet. It's not.
Well, and it's interesting because I try to think about how to step into the minds of the people who are facing these problems, because I understand if you're, you know, a movie producer or you know, someone who writes music, you don't want pirated content to take away from your living, right? So there's two different cases. There's collateral damage, you know, really legit businesses that could be taken down by mistaken sort of practices, and then there's the egregious sort of stuff. And on the egregious sort of stuff, my spam fighting instinct kicks in a little bit. So to be a good spammer, you need reputation, like links, you need content, something that the search engine can key off of. But most importantly, you need a way to monetize. And there's been a study where people looked at email spam, and they basically figured out that most of the credit card processing went through something like three banks based in Eastern Europe. And so a lot of the times, if you actually follow the money to either the credit card processors or the other payment processors, you'll find that there's some very small points where you could actually have a big impact there. And so there is an act called Open where people are talking about following the money.
Yeah, but Matt,
having worked,
but yeah. Matt, how well has that worked in stopping email spam?
You know, the interesting thing on email spam is I think Gmail has been a huge technological improvement over what was previously working with
because
email
you're
spam.
Filtering it, not because you're stopping it.
Because we're because
90,
we're
what is doing, it? 95% of all traffic on the internet is still spam.
Yeah, but for an average user, they don't have to see spam in their inbox.
Well, but that's my point. There are technological solutions, but you cannot stop piracy. You cannot stop spam. If black holes, if blacklists worked, like they're proposing in SOPA and PIPA, we wouldn't have any spam. They don't work.
Oh, I'm totally familiar with that.
Yeah, right? we haven't stopped spam. We just don't see it.
Right. Well, and what's interesting is the very first thing I worked on at Google was Safe Search, which is our family filter. And there was a Dilbert that came out that basically said, so you're going to try to keep every 14-year-old boy from getting to porn? You know, did you know that a snowball lasts longer in hell if you put a little hat on it? You know? And so you can't keep people who really are going to go to, you know, they'll go all over to find stuff. But you can try to make it easier so that people don't run across it on a daily
right.
basis. But what doesn't work, because I've seen, you know, how the brittle aspect of blacklists dealing with trying to mark explicit porn sites and not the idea of outsourcing that through a private right of action to other companies who don't necessarily aren't necessarily as tech savvy. That just seems like a recipe for disaster.
Somebody in the chat room is saying, well, what about physical goods? What about Chanel handbags and Rolex watches? I would submit that anybody who would buy a fake Chanel handbag or Rolex wristwatch would not buy the original under any circumstances anyway. So what you cannot say is that Rolex loses money to fake Rolex wristwatches.
No, and in fact, Leo, I went to a meeting by Richemont in South Africa last year, and they talked about what they're going to offer. Is the danger there really is that someone thinks they're buying a real one and get ripped off.
Okay.
And that a phony gets passed off. So what they see the need to do is to create new verification mechanisms so before you buy it, you can verify that this is real.
But that's not the overseas website problem, because if you're buying Chanel handbags from an overseas website.
No, you're right. Well, you should just know better. And you're right, Leo. You're not going to buy it. You're not going to buy a real one anyway.
Right.
here's another way to look at it. There were more cases today. Zappos. We're looking at so many things the wrong way. And I wish I'd been on with Steve before this to ask him this question. Slightly off topic, but all the security breaches, and oh my God, people have my credit card number and my address and my social security number. Shouldn't we set up transactional methods so that it doesn't matter if anybody has my credit card, my social security number, or whatever? Right? We're doing it this wrong way. We're trying to play the whack-a-mole that Matt's talking about of getting rid of the bad guys rather than creating new and better systems and models. If we had some means that was biometric and informational that let me and only me do transactions under my name, then I wouldn't care if anybody has my social security number. It's not the secret to my universe. We're doing it the wrong way. So same here. I think that Matt's quite right. Is to try to stop that thing from happening isn't going to work. So you create better systems that bring the good stuff up, make it easier to buy things. Steve Jobs proved that worked in music. Is the revenue the same? Is the monopoly pricing the same? Well, no. But welcome to a new world.
Everybody have a chance to speak along to these lines. Matt, you have anything else you want to say before we move along? I think we're preaching to the converted here.
Yeah.
I think anybody who's watching this show knows exactly why they hate SOPA.
but it is very cool when you were talking to the EFF guy to hear that 29 Congress people have reversed their position today. That's pretty wild.
And as you say, this is much larger than PIPA and SOPA. This is... I think you could look. We'll be able to look back on this day and say this is the day the internet showed its power, and we, the people of the internet, maybe do have a little bit of clout, and we're not just a bunch of neck bearded guys in their underwear sitting in their basements.
Plus, one thing that made me very happy about the discussion in the White House statement was that it rose to the level of principle. And you know, that's what I talk about in my book is the need for discussion of principles. because we get down in the nitty-gritty of trying to recreate an old model or protect one little thing, we've got to deal with the full principles, the precedents that occur here, and the why and the wherefore. And at some point, the White House has to decide, and Congress has to decide, is it more important to protect an entertainment company or free speech? And where are they going to put their capital and effort in doing this? And we have to have this discussion at the level of principles and protecting these principles for a future. And that's what I'm so delighted about is that we're having here. We're saying that SOPA is one of many bad things going on in trying to screw up the internet, but this is the one where it went too far, and this is the one we're going to stop, and we're going to have this discussion on the basis of principles.
And I hope this strengthens our muscle.
Yes.
And our protest muscle, and now that we understand that we have some say in the matter, that we all stay involved and active. We vote. We pay attention to these issues. But now, you know, I think it's really important that we have a balance, a dissenting viewpoint. So, ladies and gentlemen, we take you to Rupert Murdoch, who says,
so Obama has thrown in his lot with Silicon Valley paymasters who threaten all software creators with piracy. Please.
Leo, can you do that with an Australian accent, too, please?
Yeah. Plain thievery. Piracy leader is Google, who streams movies free, sells advertisements around them. No wonder pouring millions into lobbying.
So, as you point out in your... This is from Jeff's blog post saying Rupert Murdoch doesn't understand links.
He really doesn't.
It's all your fault, Matt Cutts. I blame you. I don't know what to say about this.
He thinks to link to things is to steal them. Rather than sending an audience. He does not understand that basic structure. So he's always thought that aggregators were content kleptomaniacs, in the words of one of his recently ousted lieutenants. And now he thinks that for Google to just link to bad stuff is Google doing it. And he thinks the whole internet is owned by Google. I saw
here's the smoking gun post.
I've just been to Google search for Mission Impossible. Wow! Several sites offering free links. I rest my case.
Jeff Berkovici says that happened at CES when he got a demo of Google TV and was shown how to search for TV. And he asked, if I search for Mission Impossible, will, you know, these bad things come up too? And the answer was, well, yeah,
search.
And he went berserk. He says in his latest post 19 hours ago, don't care about people not buying movies, programs, or newspapers, just stealing them.
I'm sorry? So if we don't buy anything from him ever again, he won't. He doesn't care about that.
No problem.
No problem. Just don't steal.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, that there is some internal consistency to that, because the presumption being that if once stolen, that was a purchase that we've lost.
But he accuses Google of being the thief.
Right. You stole it instead of buying it. Oh, it says AFL-CIO supports SOPA. Well, we better talk to those union leaders. How about that? I have to say, though, I'm not. I don't want to make too much fun of Rupert, because at least he's tweeting. I mean, this is him, obviously. And how many CEOs? Only a guy like Rupert Murdoch, with huge amounts of power within his company, would get the permission to tweet.
He doesn't ask permission.
He just does.
Yeah, he gives it.
Yeah. I'm going to say what I want. All right, but now it's Matt's turn to get on the hot seat. And we're going to do that in just a little bit, because Google made some big changes. I don't know, Matt, if you saw Twit this week, but we went into great detail with Danny Sullivan about this Search Plus My World and some of the real interesting conflict of interest issues that it raises. And I'm going to give you every chance to respond to that. So we'll do that in just a little bit. This is, of course, the day the internet fought back. That's why we're in black and white. We invite you to go to blackout.eff.org or americancensorship.org or reddit.com or one of wordpress.com or wired.com and learn more, wikipedia.org, and learn more about this and what you can do, primarily, chief of which is call your member of Congress. Now, of course, we're a global show. More than a third of our audience is outside the U.S. Don't think this doesn't affect you. These laws are being passed all over the world, most recently Spain, France, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the running dog of the U.S. content industry, is working on passing bills exactly like this all over the world. So the fight goes on everywhere. You're just as much at risk as we are. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this best of this week in Google as much as we've enjoyed doing Google this week in Google all year long. Such a great show. And we like to thank all the people who join us on a regular basis, like Google's own Matt Cutts, Kevin Marks, Kevin Purdy. There's so many great people to do the show with us. Aaron Newcomb. It's so much fun. And remember, it's not just about Google. It's about the cloud. It's about Facebook. It's about Twitter. It's about these new technologies that are really changing how we interact, how we communicate, impact things like privacy and security. So I think we're going to have a lot to talk about with Gina, Jeff, and me in 2013. I hope you'll join us. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific. That's about 4 p.m. Eastern time, 2100 UTC, on twit.tv. Live is great if you can watch, because I love the interaction we get from the chat room. But if you can't watch live, please download audio or video of the show after the fact. In fact, do me a favor, subscribe. That way you'll get every episode. We really appreciate that. Have a safe, happy, and healthy new year, and we'll see you right back here in 2013. I'm Leo Laporte. Take care.